Falcon swore viciously as at least 10 men seemed to appear out of the very ground. Two of them carried crossbows, but all the rest had drawn swords, and the crossbowmen dropped their ungainly, slow-firing weapons and reached for their own swords. "Run, Highness!" the lieutenant shouted as he sensed Caleb bouncing back to his feet behind him. "Fuck that!" the crown prince spat back, and his steel scraped as he drew his own blade. "God damn it, Caleb, run!" Falcon bellowed, and the attackers were upon them. The assassin leader was confident in his own skill, but a faint warning bell rang somewhere inside him as his unexpected opponent's peculiar stance registered. The mysterious newcomer held the hilt of his weapon in both hands, just above eye level, with one foot advanced and his entire body turned at a slight angle. It was unlike any stance the assassin had ever seen, but he had no time to analyze it. Not before the hovering weapon hissed forward like a steel lightning bolt. The sheer, blazing speed of the stroke took the assassin by surprise, but he was just as good as his reputation claimed. He managed to interpose his own broadsword, despite his opponent's speed, and even though he'd never encountered an attack quite like this one, it didn't help. He had one brief instant for his eyes to begin to widen in shocked disbelief as the newcomer's blade sliced cleanly through his own, and then his head leapt from his shoulders. Arnald Falcon parried frantically as the first sword came chopping in. Steel jarred on steel with an ugly anvil-like clang, and he twisted aside as a second blade reached for him. He heard more metal clashing on metal and swore with silent desperation as he realized Caleb, instead of running while he and Dimitri tried to slow the assassins, had fallen into formation with them. Only three things kept the Crown Prince and either of his marines alive for the next few seconds. One was the two crossbowmen's need to discard one weapon and draw another, which slowed them and dropped them a little behind the other 10 attackers. The second was the fact that all of the assassins coming at them had expected those crossbows to do the job without any need to engage anyone hand-to-hand. They'd been just as surprised by the mysterious stranger's intervention as Falcon had been by their own attack, and their rush towards the prince and his bodyguards was a scrambling, unorganized thing. They didn't come together in a tightly organized attack. And the third thing was that Caleb had ignored Falcon's order to run. The first assassin to reach the crown prince leapt towards him, sword slashing, only to stumble back with a sobbing scream as Caleb unleashed a short, powerful lunge. King Harald had imported a weapons master from Kuznetsov in South Harchong, and while the Empire might be decadent, might be corrupt, and was definitely insufferably arrogant, it still boasted some of the finest weapons instructors in the world. Master Domnek was at least as arrogant as any Harchong stereotype, but he was also just as good at his craft as he thought he was, and a relentless taskmaster. Most Safeholdian swordsmen were trained in the old school, but Caleb had been taught by someone who recognized that swords had points for a reason. His savage, economic lunge drove a foot of steel through his opponent's chest, and he'd recovered back into a guard position before his victim hit the ground. A second assassin came hurtling in on the crown prince, only to collapse, this time with little more than a gurgling moan, as Caleb's second thrust went home at the base of his throat. Falcon was too heavily engaged against two other opponents to allow his attention to stray, but he was agonizingly aware that the assassins were concentrating their efforts against Caleb. The fact that they were was probably the only reason Falcon and Dimitri were still alive, yet he didn't expect to stay that way for long against 3-1 odds. But then, something new was added. The assassin's second-in-command heard a scream from behind him and grinned nastily at the evidence that his commander had dealt with the interfering busybody who'd spoiled their ambush. But then he heard a second scream, and he backed off a couple of paces from the confusion of blades and bodies around the Carisian prince and his outnumbered bodyguards and tried to look back the way he'd come. He just had time to take in the crumpled bodies of his two crossbowmen, and then the man who'd killed both of them was upon him in a swirl of steel. Unlike his late commander, this assassin had no time to register anything peculiar about his opponent's stance. He was too busy dying as the newcomer drove a two-handed thrust straight through his lungs and heart, twisted his wrists, and recovered his blade all in one graceful movement and without ever breaking stride. Arnald Falcon got through to one of his attackers. The man fell back with a groan, dropping the dirk in his offhand as his left arm went limp, but then the lieutenant grunted in anguish as a sword got through his own guard and gashed the outside of his left thigh. He staggered, staying on his feet somehow, but his sword wavered, and then another blade came driving at him. He managed to beat the attack aside, carrying his attacker's sword to the left, but that left him uncovered on the right, and he sensed another assassin coming in on him. And then that assassin went down himself, instantly dead, as a gory steel thunderbolt impacted on the nape of his neck like a hammer and severed his spinal cord. Falcon wasted no time trying to understand what had just happened. There were still armed men trying to kill his prince, and he used the distraction of the stranger's attack to finish off his wounded adversary. He heard Dimitri groan behind him even as the dead man fell, and cursed as the marine went down, uncovering Caleb's left side. Falcon knew the prince was exposed, but the wounded lieutenant was still too heavily engaged with his sole remaining opponent to do anything about it. Caleb saw Dimitri collapse from the corner of one eye. He knew what that meant, and he tried to wheel to face the man who'd cut down his bodyguard. But the two men already attacking him redoubled their efforts, pinning him in place. The prince's mind was clear and cold, focused as Master Domnek had taught him, yet beyond the shield of that focus was a stab of cold terror as he waited for Dimitri's killer to take him from the flank. But then, suddenly, someone else was at his side. Someone whose flashing blade cut down two foes in what seemed a single motion. The three surviving would-be assassins abruptly realized that the odds had somehow mysteriously become even. They fell back as if by common consent, but if they'd intended to break off the attack, they'd left it too late. Caleb stepped forward, lunging in court. Another of his attackers folded forward over the bitter thrust of his blade, and the stranger who'd mysteriously materialized at his left side lopped off another head in almost the same instant. It was the first time Caleb had actually heard of anyone managing that in a single, clean, one-handed blow, outside some stupid heroic ballad at least, and the sole remaining assassin seemed as impressed by it as the crown prince. He whirled to flee, and Caleb was in the act of recovering his stance, unable to interfere as the man turned to run. But the stranger's sword licked out with blinding speed, and the assassin shrieked as he was neatly hamstrung. He collapsed, and the stranger stepped forward. A booted foot slammed down on the back of the wounded man's sword hand, evoking another scream as it crushed the small bones. The assassin twisted, his left hand scrabbling at the hilt of the dagger at his hip, and the stranger's sword licked out again, severing the tendons in his wrist. It was over in a heartbeat, and then Caleb found himself facing the stranger who had just saved his life across the sobbing body of the only surviving attacker. "It occurred to me," the stranger said in an odd, clipped accent, strange sapphire eyes bright, "that you might want to ask this fellow a few questions about who sent him, Your Highness." 2. Harith Foothills near Rothar, Kingdom of Karis. Crown Prince Caleb knew he was staring at his totally unanticipated rescuer, but he couldn't help it. The newcomer looked unlike anyone he'd ever seen before. His complexion was paler even than Father Peter Wilson's, and Caleb had never seen eyes of such a deep, dark blue. Yet while Father Peter's complexion and gray eyes went with an unruly shock of bright red hair, this man's hair was as dark as Caleb's own, and he was taller even than Caleb by a full 2 inches. He was also quite improbably handsome, in spite of the thin white scar which seamed his right cheek. In some ways, his features were almost effeminate, despite his fiercely waxed mustachios and neat dagger beard. Yet that, like the piratical-looking scar, only gave his face a certain exotic cast. All in all, a most impressive character, and one who'd arrived at the proverbial last second. Which, of course, raised the question of just how he'd managed to do that. Caleb might not have been the most bookish scholar his tutors had ever encountered, but he'd been well grounded in basic logic, history, and statecraft, and his father had personally undertaken his instruction in the essential suspicion any head of state required. While he was perfectly well aware that coincidences truly did happen, he was also aware that some coincidences were made to happen, especially when the people responsible for them were engaged in a shadowy struggle for the highest stakes imaginable. "I hope you'll forgive me for pointing this out," the prince said, without cleaning or sheathing his own blade. "But you appear to have a certain advantage. You know who I am, but I have no idea who you are, sir."
"Which must certainly appear suspicious under the circumstances, Your Highness," the stranger observed with a smile, and bowed ever so slightly. "I'm called Merlin, Prince Caleb, Merlin Athrawis, and the reason the circumstances appear suspicious is because they are. I scarcely happened along by accident, and explaining how I did come to arrive will require some time. For now, however..." He bent and ripped a handful of fabric from his last whimpering victim's tunic, used it to wipe his blade, and sheathed the steel smoothly. Both this fellow here and Lieutenant Falcon would seem to require a little attention. Caleb twitched as he was reminded and looked quickly at the lieutenant. Falcon sat on the pine needles, his eyes glassy as he used both hands to staunch the flow of blood from his wounded thigh, and the Crown Prince took a quick step in his direction. Then he froze, his eyes whipping back to Merlin, as he realized how thoroughly and effortlessly the stranger had redirected his attention. But the other man simply stood there, arms folded across his chest, and raised one sardonic eyebrow. Caleb flushed. On the other hand, if the stranger had wished him harm, there'd been no reason to interfere in the ambush in the first place. That didn't mean he might not have some deeper, subtly inimical purpose in mind, but it seemed unlikely that burying a dagger in the prince's back was among his immediate plans. The Crown Prince dropped to his knees beside Falcon. Rather than waste time cleaning his own sword and returning it to the scabbard, he laid it on the pine needles, then drew his dagger and began slicing open the leg of the lieutenant's breeches. The wound was ugly enough, and bleeding freely, but without the heavy, pulsing flow of arterial blood. He unbuttoned the huntsman's pouch on his left hip and quickly extracted the rolled bandage of boiled cotton. He covered the wound with a pad of Fleming moss, then wrapped the bandage tightly around Falcon's thigh, applying pressure to the wound. If pressure and the absorbent, healing moss didn't stop the bleeding, he had a packet of curved needles and boiled thread to close the wound with stitches, but he was scarcely a trained surgeon. He preferred to leave that sort of repair to someone who knew what he was doing. The lieutenant had slumped back, eyes closed, while the prince worked on him. By the time Caleb tied the bandage off, though, Falcon's eyes were open once more. The Marine turned his head, and his mouth tightened with more than the physical pain of his own wound as he saw Dragoner's and Dimitri's bodies. Then he looked outward at the sprawled corpses of the assassins, and his eyes narrowed as he saw the mysterious Merlin kneeling beside the one surviving attacker. Merlin's hands had been busy attending to the other man's wounds even as Caleb saw to Falcon's, although it was apparent from the assassin's sounds that the stranger wasn't wasting a great deal of gentleness upon him. Falcon's head rolled back, his gaze met Caleb's, and both eyebrows rose in question. Caleb looked back at him, then shrugged. The lieutenant grimaced, then pushed himself up, with the prince's assistance and a grunt of pain, into a sitting position. Caleb positioned himself unobtrusively to allow the marine to lean back against him, and Falcon cleared his throat.
"Excuse me?"
he said, looking up at the man who'd saved not only the prince's life, but his own.
"But I think we need a few answers, sir."
The man who'd introduced himself to Caleb as Merlin, and who had decided he really needed to work on never thinking of himself as Nimmu Alban, smiled. The expression was rather more confident than he actually felt, but he'd known this moment, or one very like it, was going to come.
"Well, not exactly like this one," he amended.
It was sheer serendipity that his snark had not only stumbled across the plot to assassinate Crown Prince Caleb, but that he'd actually managed to arrive in time to help foil it. "Good thing I did, too. I already knew Caleb was a good-looking kid, but I hadn't realized quite how much presence he has, especially for someone who's barely 19 standard. If I can just get him to trust me, I can do something with him. Assuming, of course, that I can figure out a way to go on keeping him alive." "I am known," he told Falcon, "as I've already informed Prince Caleb, as Merlin Athrawes. And I'm not at all surprised you have some questions, Lieutenant Falcon. I certainly would in your place. And while I may be confident I cherish no ill designs upon the prince, there's no reason you should feel that way. So, if you have questions I can answer, ask them." Falcon cocked his head, his expression wary, then bought a little time by easing his wounded leg's position with a wince of pain, which was not at all feigned. He was uncomfortably aware that his own lightheadedness scarcely made this the ideal time for a probing, insightful interrogation. Unfortunately, this was the only time, and the only wit, he had. Besides, something about Merlin's manner made him suspect he would be outclassed in any battle of wits with him at the best of times. "Since you've been courteous enough to acknowledge that my duty to my prince requires me to be suspicious of apparent coincidences," he said, after a moment, "perhaps you might begin by telling me how you happened along at such an extremely opportune moment." Caleb stirred slightly behind him, but stilled as Falcon reached back unobtrusively and squeezed his ankle. He knew the Crown Prince well enough to be aware that, despite Caleb's own recognition of the need to be cautious, he retained sufficient of childhood's romantic faith in heroic ballads and how the characters in them ought to act to feel uncomfortable at such a direct challenge. But this Athrawes, and what sort of surname was that anyway, seemed more amused than offended. He took time to recheck his rough but efficient repairs to the crippled assassin, then folded down gracefully to sit tailor fashion on the pine needles. "To begin at the beginning, Lieutenant," he said then, in that strangely clipped accent, "I come from the Mountains of Light. Although I wasn't born there, I've made my home among their peaks for many years, and after long and careful study, I've been blessed with some, at least, of the powers of a Seijin." Falcon's eyes narrowed, and Caleb inhaled audibly behind him. The Mountains of Light contained the second holiest site of Safehold, the mighty peak of Mount Olympus, where the Archangel Langhorne had first set foot upon the solid earth of Safehold when God established the firmament in the misty dawn of creation. And the Seijin were a legend in their own right. Warriors, holy men, sometimes prophets, and sometimes teachers. Only the archangels themselves could endure Surgoi Kasai, God's own mystic fire, but the Seijin had been touched by Anshin Ritsume, God's little fire, and it rendered them men forever set apart from other mortals. To the lieutenant's knowledge, no authentic Seijin had ever visited the kingdom of Karis, and the mere fact that someone claimed to be one proved nothing. Although, he conceded, it would take more nerve than most people possess to claim Seijin status falsely.
"That's an interesting statement, sir," Falcon said slowly, after a moment.
"And one difficult to prove," Merlin agreed. "Believe me, Lieutenant, you can't be more aware of that fact than I am." He smiled wryly and leaned back, stroking one waxed mustachio with the fingers of his right hand. "In fact, I must admit that I never anticipated I might find myself called to such a role. Still, I believe the writ warns us that our tasks in life will seek us out, wherever we may be, and whatever we may plan." Falcon nodded. Again, he had the distinct impression that Athrawes was amused by his questions, his suspicion. Still, he sensed no malice in the other man. His own current dizziness made him distrust his instincts, yet he found himself more curious than threatened. "For quite some time," Merlin continued, his expression more serious, "I've been gifted with the sight. I sometimes see events which take place thousands of miles away, although I've never seen into the future or the past, as some have claimed to do. That ability to see distant events is what led me to Karis at this time. While I may not be able to see the future, I have seen other visions. Visions concerning Karis, Crown Prince Caleb and his father, and their enemies. Somehow I find it difficult to believe such visions would be given to me if I weren't meant to act upon them."
"Forgive me," Caleb said, his expression intent. "But if, as you say, you can't see the future, then how did you know about this?"
He took one hand from Falcon's shoulder and waved at the carnage all about them.
"Your Highness," Merlin said, almost gently, "surely you aren't so naive as to believe this attack simply materialized out of thin air this morning. You have enemies, Prince, enemies who, whether they realize it or not, serve darkness, and I've seen many visions of their plans and plots, of correspondence and orders passing between them. I've known for almost half a year that they intended to bring about your death in any way they could. This isn't their first plan, but simply the first which came this close to success. I've been traveling from the Temple Lands to Karis for many 5 days now, ever since I became aware that they were preparing to move from mere plans to actual execution, if you'll pardon the choice of words." He smiled, showing improbably white, perfect teeth, and Caleb frowned.
"Don't think me ungrateful," he said, "but I find it difficult to believe I'm so righteous that God himself would send a Seijin to save me."
"I suspect you're more righteous than many, Your Highness, possibly even than most. After all, at your age, how much opportunity have you had to become unrighteous?"
Merlin chuckled and shook his head.
"However, I'm not at all sure your personal righteousness has anything to do with it. You seem a nice enough young man, but I rather suspect that what brought me here has more to do with what you may accomplish in the future than anything you've already done."
"Accomplish in the future?" Caleb stiffened, and Merlin shrugged.
"As I've already said, Your Highness, it's never been given to me to see the future. I do, however, see the patterns of the present, and what I've seen of your father's rule gives me a very good opinion of him. I know..."
He held up one hand with an easy smile.
"I know, presumptuous of me to judge the worth of any king, and especially of a king not my own. Still, there it is. His people are happy and prosperous, and until certain other parties began actively plotting against him, they were secure as well.
And he spent years training you, which suggests you would continue in the same mold as King. At any rate, and for whatever reason those visions have come to me, it seemed evident your enemies were prepared, or preparing, to strike directly at either you, your father, or both. There was nothing I could do about it from my home, and so I took ship for Karras. I arrived 3 days ago, aboard Captain Charles's ship.
Madoc Charles?
Falcon asked more sharply than he'd intended to, and Merlin nodded.
Yes. I traveled cross-country to Sidar, and I was fortunate enough to find Wave Daughter there with a load of Zebedean tea. Captain Charles had run into some sort of problem with the customs officers, which took several 5 days to straighten out, but he'd finally gotten it taken care of just before I arrived. He was headed home with a cargo of Sidarmark brandy, and I needed a ride.
Merlin smiled again.
If the good captain is typical of the way you Carizians haggle, it's small wonder so many of you envy your trading ship's successes.
Captain Charles drives a hard bargain, Falcon agreed. I suppose it comes from all the years he's spent as a purser in the Navy.
You need more practice at trapping liars, Lieutenant, Merlin told him with a chuckle.
Captain Charles was never a purser. In fact, I believe he told me he holds a reserve commission in your Navy, as a full shipmaster, if I recall correctly.
Caleb snorted behind Falcon, and Merlin winked at the Crown Prince.
Besides, he added, it would be particularly stupid of me to give you the name of both captain and ship if I were lying, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would, Falcon acknowledged. Still, given the uncanny nature of your tale, I'm sure you realize we will be speaking to Captain Charles.
Merlin simply nodded with another small smile, and Falcon inhaled deeply.
So, you arrived in Telesburg 3 days ago. Why didn't you make your presence known sooner?
Oh, come now, Lieutenant!
This time Merlin laughed out loud.
Suppose I'd walked up to the palace gate 3 days ago, rung the bell, and informed the commander of the palace guard that I'd journeyed all the way from the temple lands to Karras because I had a vision that the crown prince was in danger? And could I possibly have a personal audience with him to explain all that, please? Given all the political currents and cross-currents swirling about between Karras, Emerald, Coruscant, and Taro, how do you think Colonel Ropewalk would have reacted?
Not well, Falcon admitted, noting once more that whoever and whatever else this Athrawes might actually be, he was fiendishly well informed about events and people here in Karras.
Not well is putting it mildly, Lieutenant, Merlin snorted. I'm sure he would have been at least reasonably polite about it, but I'd still be sitting in a cell somewhere while he tried to figure out which of your many enemies had sent me.
He shook his head.
I'm afraid Colonel Ropewalk doesn't have a very trusting disposition.
Which is why he's the commander of the palace guard, Falcon pointed out.
I'm sure. But without any way to prove my bona fides, it seemed best to me to find myself an inn and take a room while I waited to see what would happen next. At that time, I had no knowledge of any immediate specific threat to the king or to the prince.
Indeed, Merlin said with total honesty, it was only late yesterday evening that I became aware of this particular plot. In my visions, I'd already seen these men's commander.
A jerk of his head indicated the body sprawled around them,
receiving instructions and passing on instructions of his own. But only last night did I see him issuing orders for this attack. And, by the way, it was he who saw to it that one of the prince's huntsmen heard about this slash lizard as well. I'm afraid he and his masters had a very good idea of how the prince would react to the news. Thanks to my vision, I knew what was intended, but I had absolutely no evidence I could have presented to anyone. Had I been in your boots, Lieutenant, I would have been most suspicious of any total stranger who arrived on my doorstep this morning with tales of hidden assassins lurking in the forest.
I would have had the stranger in question detained, at least until I could get to the bottom of his preposterous story, which would just happen to have put the only person, other than the murderers, of course, who knew anything about the plan, in a position from which he could accomplish nothing. So, instead of trying to warn you, I came ahead, determined to do what I could to spoil their plans myself.
Merlin paused, and his strange sapphire eyes darkened as he gazed briefly at the two dead Marines.
I regret that I couldn't find a way to do it which would have kept the rest of your men alive, Lieutenant. Perhaps if I could see the future, I might have been able to.
Falcon sat silent for several minutes, gazing at the blue-eyed stranger. The lieutenant felt certain there were a great many things this Athrawes wasn't telling or was glossing over. And yet he also felt oddly certain the mysterious foreigner truly did wish young Caleb well. And whatever else he might be up to, without his intervention, the prince would most assuredly be dead at this moment. Moreover, it was Athrawes who'd seen to it that they had at least one of the assassins to interrogate, which he would hardly have done if that interrogation might implicate him in any plots. It was always possible Athrawes, or someone he worked for, had designs of his own upon Karras. He might know exactly who'd sent the assassins and be working at cross-purposes to that particular enemy without being a friend himself. At the same time, however, he'd provided a wealth of detail about his own arrival in Karras, which could readily be checked, and it might well be possible to test his claim to see visions as well. For the moment, the lieutenant decided, he had no choice but to take the Sajin claim at least tentatively seriously. Where that might lead, if indeed it proved accurate, was anyone's guess. Except, of course, that those who wished his kingdom ill would not be at all pleased to hear about it.
3. Telesburg, Kingdom of Karras.
What happened?
How do I know? Oscar Mulvane replied irritably.
He glowered at Jaspar Mycene, his immediate superior. The two of them sat at a table in a street-side cafe only 2 blocks from the wharves, sipping cups of strong, sweet, Dolorin chocolate. The cafe was on the west side of the street, which had put it into cool shadow as the sun moved steadily towards evening, for which both men were devoutly grateful. And seabirds and sand wyverns foraged for scraps in a square across from it, where the produce hucksters had just closed their booths for the day. Despite the noise and bustle of a typical busy Telesburg day, the scene was reassuringly normal and calm. Which might well change in the next few hours, Mulvane thought, and shrugged one shoulder.
Caleb went out, he came back. Alive, he said.
That much I figured out for myself, Mason said sarcastically. And I know 2 of his bodyguards came back dead, and another one came back wounded, too.
Then you should also know the gate guard was told to expect a pair of wagons shortly. One's supposed to have a dead slash lizard in it, the other one's supposed to be piled up with dead assassins. A full wagon load, over 12.
Mulvane bared his teeth in a caricature of a smile.
I don't suppose you'd care to guess just who all of those dead assassins might be.
Shan Wei, Mason muttered. How could they screw up that badly against just 5 bodyguards?
Well, Mulvane said philosophically, at least we don't have any explaining to do.
He paused and looked at his superior closely.
We don't, do we?
Not likely, Mason snorted. You think I'd be sitting around here talking to you if there were any chance something like this might lead back to me?
It would seem a little foolish, Mulvane agreed.
The only thing more foolish I could think of right off hand would be going home to tell him in person that I'd been involved in anything this stupid.
Mulvane chuckled, although, in truth, neither of them felt particularly amused. He started to say something else,
then paused as the waiter stopped by their table to offer refills on their chocolate. Maison raised one eyebrow at him, and Mulvane nodded. The imported chocolate was expensive, but Mulvane's cover as the representative of a Desneri banking house and Maison's cover as the owner of a small fleet of merchant ships gave them the resources to indulge themselves from time to time. The waiter poured, then departed, and Mulvane waited until the young man was out of earshot before speaking again. Their table was right at the edge of the slightly raised sidewalk, which put them very close to the cobblestone street. It was hardly a preferred location for most of the cafe's patrons. The noise of horse hooves, the grating roar of iron-shod wheels over cobbles, the burbling whistles of draft dragons, and the constant surf of background voices made it difficult to carry on a comfortable conversation. That same racket, however, also made it extremely difficult for anyone to overhear what they might have to say to one another. "Actually," Mulvane said in a more serious tone, when he was certain no one else was in earshot, "from the rumors I've heard, it ought to have worked." "The rumors are already busy?" Maison looked amused, and Mulvane shrugged.
"The rumors are always busy. In this case, the mayor of Rotha sent a messenger ahead. The yokel he chose passed his message to the gate guards, then found himself a tavern and had a few beers."
Mulvane raised one hand and waggled it back and forth.
"By the time he had three or four of them inside him, he was waxing eloquent. How much of it was accurate, I don't know, of course."
"Of course," Maison nodded.
Half a spy's job consisted of picking up rumors which might or might not be true and passing them along. If he was smart, he eliminated all the ones he could demonstrate were inaccurate, and was honest with his employer about the ones whose veracity he doubted. Not that all spies were smart, in Maison's experience.
"Bearing that in mind," Mulvane continued, "it sounds like everything went pretty much according to plan. They had the prince out in the woods, and he'd sent two or three of his bodyguards back for horses. And they'd brought along crossbows, so they shouldn't even have had to get into sword's reach of them."
Maison looked impressed, almost against his will. He cupped his chocolate in both hands, sipping thoughtfully, then shook his head.
"If they had a wagon load of men and they had the target just where they wanted him, what the hell went wrong?"
"That's the interesting part," Mulvane said. "According to our beer-loving messenger, everything was going exactly the way it should have until some mysterious stranger interfered."
"Mysterious stranger?" Maison repeated.
"That's what he said. Some fellow with strange blue eyes who killed at least a dozen assassins single-handedly."
"Of course he did," Maison snorted sarcastically. "I may not have been impressed with the quality of our associates' brains, Oscar, but they were reasonably competent in their own limited area."
"Agreed, but this fellow was pretty insistent. According to him, and he stuck by it through at least three complete repetitions before I had to leave to make our appointment here, it was the stranger who warned Caleb's bodyguards about the attack, and then he apparently slaughtered the attackers right and left himself. If we're going to believe the messenger's version of things, Caleb and this stranger were the only two still on their feet when it was all over."
"Really?"
Maison leaned back, lips pursed.
"That is interesting,"
he murmured, so softly even Mulvane could scarcely hear him through the background noise. "If this fellow was that insistent, then he was probably telling the truth, at least as far as he knows the truth. Did he have anything to say about how this stranger of his happened to be there?"
"According to him, the stranger was obviously sent by God," Mulvane said.
The two of them looked at one another across the table, their eyes amused.
"After all, how else could he have arrived at exactly the right moment to save the Crown Prince?"
"Somehow I doubt God had a great deal to do with it," Maison said dryly. "Which isn't to say someone else didn't. Were our friends indiscreet, do you think?"
There must have been. Although, Mulvane frowned, I wouldn't have expected it of them. Admittedly, they were basically blunt instruments, but they knew Harald's agents are watching everywhere for assassins these days, and they were experienced.
Not the sort to blab about their plans where someone might hear, you mean?
Exactly. Besides, if that was what happened, why was only one stranger involved? We're talking about Caleb. If they truly believed someone meant to try to kill him, they'd have had an entire regiment out there, not just one man.
Unless that one man was the only one who'd realized what our less adroit associates intended to do, Maison said thoughtfully.
Even then, he should have gone straight to the guard with it, Mulvane argued.
Unless he truly is a stranger, not a Carisian at all, and he saw this as an opportunity to win the prince's confidence.
Huh?
Mulvane scratched one eyebrow, frowning thoughtfully out across the busy street, then looked back at Maison.
That could be it, he conceded. A rather risky strategy, though, I'd have said. One man would stand a pretty good chance of getting himself killed trying to play a hero against a wagon load of assassins. Assuming this really was the work of the people we think it was, and I'm pretty sure it was, there'd have been at least a dozen of them. Pretty steep odds, don't you think?
I certainly wouldn't care for them, Maison nodded. On the other hand, I suppose a lot would depend on just how good with a sword you actually were. That's not my area of expertise, after all. Actually, the riskiest part of the entire strategy would be that the assassins might succeed despite your intervention. You wouldn't win much of Caleb's confidence if he was dead. Besides, if he'd been killed, and you looked like you'd known about the attempt ahead of time, Harald would probably have had a few unpleasant things to say to you about your failure to bring it to someone else's attention.
At the very least.
Mulvane made a face at the oblique reminder of all the unpleasant things King Harald and his interrogators might have to say to one Oscar Mulvane under certain best-not-thought-about circumstances. But, Maison continued thoughtfully, if this stranger did manage to stymie an attempt to kill the prince, he's undoubtedly going to find himself cordially received at the palace. If he plays his cards properly, that could lead to all sorts of rewards. Or, he looked back across the table at his subordinate, influence.
Influence to accomplish what? Mulvane wondered.
Who knows? Maison shrugged. Still, I suspect our employer won't be overly pleased to discover that a new player's taken a hand. This broth's rich enough without adding another cook to the kitchen.
What do you want to do about it? Mulvane asked.
He's going to want to know about this as soon as possible, Maison replied. Unfortunately, Captain Waits just sailed.
Should we use one of the alternate couriers?
An interesting question. Maison took another sip of chocolate and considered Mulvane's query. Captain Stephen Waite's merchant ship plied a regular trading route from Telisburg, up Howell Bay and the Throat, across the Karas Sea to Coruscant, picking up whatever cargo charters he could. That ought to be enough to make him a guaranteed object of suspicion to Harald's agents, but Waite's vessel was a miserable, barely seaworthy tub, and Waite himself was a drunk who spent most of his time in port cozied up to a cask of cheap wine. No one in his right mind would trust him or his ship with anything remotely important or confidential. Unless, that was, they knew Captain Waite was actually Lieutenant Robert Bradligh of the League Navy. Lieutenant Bradligh didn't even like the taste of cheap wine, and he was far from incompetent. He couldn't afford to be, since his sea cloud was almost as ramshackle as she looked. The Royal Carisian Navy was unlikely to be fooled by surface appearances, so she truly was as down at the heels and poorly maintained as she seemed.
which made nursing Sea Cloud back and forth between Telesburg and Coruscant a non-trivial challenge even for a sober captain. Bradley and his counterpart, Lieutenant Fraser Mathis, better known in Caris as Walter Seatown, maintained Maison's communications with Prince Hector. Voyage time was almost 40 days each way at Sea Cloud's best speed, however, and Mathis's equally disreputable Francine wouldn't arrive back at Telesburg for another 3-5 days, which meant Hector wouldn't have Maison's reports for another 7, minimum, if he used the regular channels for it. There were arrangements for emergency alternates, but Maison was reluctant to use them, because none of the alternative couriers' covers were as good as Waite's or Mathis's. Their best protection was that they'd never been used, and he had no desire to risk exposing them, or himself, to Carisian agents for something which wasn't demonstrably critical. "I think we won't use any of the others," he said finally. "Not at once, at any rate. Better to use the time until Seatown's return to see what additional information we can pick up." He shook his head slowly, eyes distant. "It's only a feeling so far, but something tells me a new cook is indeed about to begin stirring this particular pot, whether we like it or not."
"Wonderful," Mulvane sighed.
He finished his cup of chocolate and stood.
"In that case, I suppose I'd better get started picking up that information," he said,
and nodded briskly to Maison before he turned away from the table. Maison watched him go, then stood himself, tossed a handful of coins onto the table, and headed off in the opposite direction.
"Stupid damned idiots!"
Brady Lehang muttered savagely as he watched Crown Prince Caleb riding past below his second-story window vantage point. The royal guards who'd been dispatched to meet the prince at the gate formed a solid, vigilant ring around him, and a marine lieutenant rode in a stretcher suspended between two horses, while three other marines rode tight-shouldered at Caleb's back. That much Lehang had more or less expected, given the preliminary reports he'd already received. What he hadn't expected was the civilian riding with the prince, and his eyes narrowed as he gazed down at the dark-haired stranger.
"So that's the bastard who screwed all of our plans to hell and gone," he thought sourly.
He still didn't have a clue how the mysterious civilian had gotten wind of the operation in the first place, or how his highly paid mercenaries could have been so inept as to allow a single busybody to completely negate so many days of careful planning.
"It ought to have worked. It would have worked, if not for him."
Lehang kept his bitter anger out of his expression, but it was harder than usual to make sure his face said only what he wanted it to say. Prince Snarman was going to be displeased. He watched the cavalcade move on up the street towards the palace, then turned away from the window. He crossed the main chamber of his modest, if comfortable, lodgings and climbed the stairs to the roof. A chorus of whistling hisses and clicking jaws greeted him, and he smiled with genuine pleasure, his frustration and anger fading, and hissed back. The wyverns in the big, subdivided rooftop coop pressed against the latticework, crowding together as they whistled for treats, and he chuckled and reached through the lattice to rub skulls and stroke necks. It was, in many ways, a foolhardy thing to do. Some of the wyverns in that coop had wingspans of over 4 feet. They could have removed a finger with a single snap of their serrated jaws, but Lehang wasn't worried. He made a comfortable living, without ever having to touch the funds his prince could have made available to him, by raising and training hunting and racing wyverns for the Carisian nobility and wealthier merchants. And the wyverns in these coops were not only his friends and pets, but also his cover in more than one way. They provided his income and his profession explained why he had a constant influx of new wyverns to replace those he sold, which conveniently hid the fact that two or three in each shipment he received were homing wyverns from Prince Narman's own coop in Erastor. Now Lahang took the enciphered report from his tunic pocket. It was written on the finest Harchong paper, incredibly thin and tough, and commensurately expensive, although that was the least of his concerns as he opened the coop door and crooned a distinctive sequence of notes. One of the wyverns inside the coop whistled imperiously at its companions. A couple of them were slow to move aside, and it slapped them smartly with its forward wings until they bent their heads obsequiously and got out of its way. Then it stood in the coop door, stretching its long neck so that Lahang could scratch its scaly throat while it crooned back to him. He spent a few moments petting the creature, then lifted it out of the coop and closed and carefully secured the door behind it. The wyvern perched on top of the coop, obediently extending one leg and watching alertly, head cocked, as he affixed the report to the message-holding ring. He made sure it was securely in position, then gathered the wyvern in both arms and walked to the corner of the roof.
"Fly well," he whispered in its ear, and tossed it upward.
The wyvern whistled back to him as it flew one complete circle around the rooftop. Then it went arrowing off to the north. He gazed after it for a moment, then drew a deep breath and turned back toward the stairs. His preliminary report would be in Prince Narman's hands within the next 6 days, but he knew his master well. The prince was going to want full details of how the plan to assassinate the Carizian heir had failed, and that meant it was going to be up to Brady Lahang to find out what had happened. Hopefully, without losing his own head in the process. 4. Royal Palace, Telesburg, Kingdom of Karis. The man called Merlin Athrawes looked around the sitting room of his guest suite in the Royal Palace of Telesburg, capital of the Kingdom of Karis. It was a pleasant, airy chamber, with the high ceilings favored in warm climates, on the second level of Queen Maritha's tower. It was also comfortably furnished, and had an excellent view of the harbor, and a room in Queen Maritha's tower was an indication of high respect. The tower, where foreign ambassadors were customarily lodged, lay on the boundary between the royal family's personal section of the palace and its more public precincts. Of course, there were no doors which led directly from the tower into the royal family's quarters, and there just happened to be that permanently manned guard post at the tower's only entrance and exit, solely, no doubt, to protect the ambassador's highly respected persons. Merlin smiled and strolled across to the mirror above the beautifully inlaid chest of drawers in the suite's bedchamber. The mirror was of silver-backed glass, and he studied the surprisingly clear, sharp reflection in its slightly wavery depths, almost as if it were a stranger's. Which, after all, it was in many ways. He grimaced, then chuckled ruefully and ran a fingertip along one of his waxed mustachios. It was, he was forced to admit, a masterful disguise. One of the features of a full-capability last-generation Pika had been its owner's ability to physically reconfigure it. It wasn't a feature Nimue Alban had ever used, but then she hadn't used her Pika at all very often. Certainly not as much as her father had hoped she would. To be honest, she'd known he would have vastly preferred for her never to have joined the Navy in the first place, and he deeply resented the demands it had placed upon her time. He'd loved her very much, and a man of his wealth and position had known the truth about the ultimate hopelessness of the Federation's position early on. She'd suspected that he hadn't intentionally brought her into a doomed world in the first place, that her birth had been an accident her mother had arranged, which very probably helped explain their divorce when she was only a child. Even if her suspicions were correct, That hadn't kept him from loving her once she'd been born, but he'd been afraid that as a serving officer in the Navy, she would die sooner than she had to. He'd wanted her to live as long as she could, and to pack as much living as possible into the time she had before the inevitable happened. Well, Merlin thought, his smile going bittersweet, looks like your decision to give me a Pika worked out after all. I'm going to have a very long time to live indeed, Daddy. He gazed deep into his own reflected blue eyes, looking for some sign of the biological person he once had been, then brushed that thought aside and gave his mustachio another twirl. Nimue Alban had never been tempted to shift genders, either in her own biological case or even temporarily using her Pika. Others had been rather more adventurous, however, and Pikas had been designed to be fully functional in every sense. And since the technology had been available, the Pika designers had seen no reason not to allow their customers to reconfigure the gender as well as the general physical appearance of their marvelous, expensive toys. Given the male-dominated nature of Safeholdian society, Nimue finally had used the capability. There were inevitably some limitations for even the most capable technology. A Pika couldn't be made significantly shorter or taller than it already was. There was some flex, but not a great deal. Shoulders could be broadened, hips could be narrowed, genitalia and pelvic structures could be rearranged, but the basic physical size of the Pika itself was pretty much fixed by the size of its original human model. Fortunately, Nimue Alban had been a woman of rather more than average height, even for her birth society, whose members had been blessed with excellent medical care and adequate diet from childhood. As a woman on Safehold, she would have been a giantess, and Merlin was quite a bit taller than most of the men he might meet. Nimue had added several judiciously placed scars here and there, like the one on Merlin's cheek as well. Merlin was a warrior, and she hadn't wanted anyone to wonder how someone had attained his years and prowess without ever even being wounded. The decision to become male hadn't been an easy one, despite the logic which made it effectively inevitable. Nimue Alban had never wanted to be a man, nor had she ever felt any particular physical attraction to women, and looking at Merlin's nude, undeniably male, and very masculine physique in a full-length mirror for the first time had left him with very mixed feelings. Fortunately, Nimue had allowed herself, or rather had allowed Merlin, 2 of Safehold's 30-day months to become accustomed to his new body. In light of the plan Nimue had evolved, Merlin was impressively muscled. Not so much for brute strength as for endurance and staying power. The fact that a Pika's basic frame and musculature were stressed to approximately 10 times the strength and toughness of a normal human, and that a Pika never tired, were simply 2 of the little secrets Merlin intended to hold in reserve. At the same time, accomplishing this mission would require him to earn the respect of those about him, and this was a muscle-powered society in which a man who aspired to influence must be prepared to demonstrate his own prowess. Enough wealth might buy respect, but Merlin couldn't simply appear with bags full of gold, and he certainly had no patent of nobility. His chosen Seijin's role would help in that respect, but he would have to demonstrate its reality, and that meant living up to a Seijin's reputation, which almost any flesh-and-blood human being would have found difficult. That was why Merlin had spent quite a bit of time experimenting with the governors on his basic physical capabilities. Nimue had never done a great deal of that, but Merlin was likely to find himself in much higher-risk environments than any into which Nimue had ever ventured in her Pika. More to the point, Merlin's survival was far more important than Nimue Alban's had ever been. So he'd set his reaction speed to a level about 20% higher than any human could have matched. He could have set it higher still. His nervous impulses traveled at light speed, through molecular circuitry and along fiber-optic conduits, without the chemical transmission process upon which biological nerves depended. And he still had that extra speed in reserve for emergencies. But it was only for emergencies, and fairly dire ones at that. Even a Seijin would be looked at askance if he seemed too quick and agile. By the same token, Merlin had adjusted his strength to about 20% above what might have been expected out of a protoplasmic human with the same apparent musculature. That left him with quite a lot of literally superhuman strength in reserve as well, and he'd set the overrides to let him call upon it at need. It had taken him every day of the 5 days Nemu had allowed to learn not simply to move like a man, but to adjust for his enhanced reaction speed and strength. Well, that and the fact that his body's center of gravity had moved vertically upward quite a bit. He'd spent a lot of that time working out with the katana and wakizashi he'd used Pei Kao Yung's fabrication module to build. He'd had Owl design and actually fabricate the weapons, and he'd cheated just a little bit with them, too. The blades looked like the work of a Harchong master swordsmith, with the characteristic ripple pattern of what Old Earth had called Damascus steel. They even carried the proof marks of Hanik Reinhard, one of the legendary swordmakers of Harchong, but they were actually made of battle steel. Orders of magnitude harder and tougher than any purely metallic alloy. Merlin could have had Owl give them an edge which was literally a molecule wide, but he'd resisted that temptation. Instead, he'd settled for one which was only as sharp as a safehold surgeon's finest scalpel for the katana. The wakizashi was quite a bit sharper than that, since he anticipated using it only in dire emergencies. The katana would be Merlin's primary weapon, and since it was made of battle steel, he could do little things like using his reserve strength to slice completely through the assassin leader's blade without worrying about nicking or dulling his own. He intended to make very certain no one but he ever cared for either of those weapons. He also intended to spend quite a lot of time carefully inspecting their edges, honing them on a regular basis, seeing to it that they were properly oiled and guarded against rust and everything else a blade made of true steel would have required. On the other hand, a Seijin was supposed to be a mysterious figure with more than merely mortal capabilities, and Merlin had no objection to carrying a sword which evoked at least a little awe. That was one reason he'd stayed with the katana, which had no exact counterpart on Safehold. The fact that it was specifically suited to the only style of fencing Nemu Alban had ever studied was another factor, but its exotic appearance should contribute to the image he needed to create. He chuckled again, then turned away from the mirror with a final stroke for his absolute genuine, inasmuch as any of him could be called genuine, mustachio. A pika had fully functional taste buds and a stomach so that its owner could sample novel cuisine while running it in remote mode. And since it might well have organic material in the aforesaid stomach, the designers had seen no reason not to utilize that material as efficiently as possible. The nanotech built into what passed for Merlin's digestive tract was fully capable of converting any food he ate into naturally growing fingernails, toenails, and hair. It couldn't begin to use all of the food an organic human being consumed in a day, however, and if Merlin was going to be forced to eat regularly, which he undoubtedly was, he'd have to dispose of the unused material at regular intervals. "So I guess I'll have to hit the head after all from time to time," he thought with a grin as he strolled back across to the window. Although Queen Maritha's tower had long since been renovated into comfortable modern guest quarters, it had been a portion of the original royal castle's outer walls when it had first been built. The wall of the tower itself was a good meter and a half thick. 5 feet, he corrected himself irritably, once again cursing that maniac Langhorne for abandoning the metric system, and he pushed the diamond-paned windows open and leaned his elbows on the immensely deep windowsill. The city made an impressive sight. It was built mainly of stone and brick. The kingdom of Karis had far better uses for good timber than wasting it building houses, and the area near the waterfront was a vast sprawl of substantial warehouses, shipyards, ropewalks, chandlers, and business offices. Farther inland, away from the warren of taverns, bistros, and bordellos which served the mariners who manned the kingdom's merchant vessels, were the homes of the thousands of workmen who labored in those same warehouses and other establishments. And farther inland still, on the rising land moving away from the harbor along the banks of the Tellus River towards the palace itself, were the townhouses and mansions of noblemen and wealthy merchants. The city's total population was in the vicinity of 100,000, which made it huge for Karis, and much more than merely respectable for Safehold generally. It also meant Tellusburg was completely ringed by farmland, whose sole purpose was to keep the city's population fed. Even so, it was necessary to import vast quantities of food on a regular basis. The Karisian merchant marine was more than equal to the task, as long as the Royal Karisian Navy maintained control of Howell Bay, but 100,000 was still an enormous population for a city built by a civilization powered only by wind, water, and muscle. It was also a remarkably clean city. Safeholdian notions of public hygiene and waste disposal were far more stringent than anything old Earth had known at any comparable technology level. Merlin was delighted that they were, too. The sorts of pestilences and plagues which had routinely swept through pre-industrial old Earth cities were very rare occurrences on Safehold. Besides, it also meant Tellusburg smelled far better than its old Earth counterparts ever had. He smiled, but then the smile faded as he saw the church spires which dominated the city's low-lying skyline. He could see literally dozens of them from where he stood, and every one of them was part of the lie which had brought him to Karis in the first place. On the other hand, he thought, every single one of them has at least one bell in its tower, too. Big ones at that. And that means foundries. Lots and lots of foundries. That's going to come in handy as hell in the not-too-distant. The dark blue waters of Howell Bay stretched northward as far as even his eyes could see. The bay was very nearly half the size of Old Earth's Mediterranean. If the body of water called the Throat were added, their combined length would have been 80% of the Mediterranean's, although they would also have been much narrower. Like the Mediterranean, the Throat and Howell Bay were almost completely landlocked, except where the Throat opened onto the Karis Sea, and they, and the Karis Sea, were utterly dominated by the Royal Karisian Navy. At the moment. Merlin pursed his lips and whistled tunelessly as he considered King Harald VII's dilemma. The kingdom of Karis was one of Safehold's more substantial kingdoms. It had grown, although the local histories didn't remember it exactly that way, out of one of the original colonial enclaves. In fact, the original site for the city of Tellusburg had been chosen by Pei Shan Wei herself during her terraforming operations. Given Shan Wei's place in the revised version of Langhorne's religion, it wasn't surprising that no one remembered that, and Tellusburg hadn't been a very large enclave. Most of those had been located on the larger landmasses of Haven and Howard, where the bulk of the planet's population was located even today. Nor had Tellusburg received much in the way of outside support, possibly because of its parentage. Yet it had grown anyway, slowly but steadily, and it had begun establishing colonies of its own about 500 local years ago. Those colonies had quickly established their independence as feudal territories in their own right, but Tellusburg had always remained the largest and most powerful of the Karisian states, first among equals, one might say. Then, about 200 local years ago, the House of Armagh had risen to power in Tellusburg under Harald III, the present king's direct ancestor. Over the last 2 centuries, the Armagh dynasty had gradually extended its control over the entire landmass known as Carris Island. Personally, Merlin considered that something of a misnomer. The island in question would have been considered a continent on most planets. Of course, its sparsely inhabited upper third or so was almost completely severed from the rest of it by the Throat and Howell Bay. The mountainous isthmus which connected it to the lower two-thirds and formed the bay's western coast between the bay and the cauldron was barely 55 kilometers, 34 miles, he corrected sourly, wide at its narrowest point. That upper portion had long been considered a completely separate landmass. In fact, it had been given its own name, Margaret's Land, and only added to the rest of the kingdom of Carris about 80 local years ago. Across the Carris Sea lay Emerald Island, about the size of Margaret's Land, and just as sparsely settled, but independent from, and resentful of, Carris. Prince Narmon of Emerald walked carefully around Carris, but his hatred of Harald and the huge Carisian merchant marine which dominated the carrying trade of Safehold was both deep and profound. The House of Bates had acquired title to Emerald less than 2 generations ago, following the unfortunate demise of every male member of the previous ruling house. As such, Narmon had a lively awareness of how a ruler's fortunes could shift abruptly. That, coupled with the fact that he was, perhaps not unreasonably, suspicious that Carris's long, steady expansion meant the Armagh dynasty ultimately had designs upon Emerald as well, only added fuel to his hatred for all things Carisian. Silverlode Island, southeast of Emerald and directly across the smaller Middle Sea and Windhover Sea from Carris, was almost as big as Carris itself. Combined with Carris, Margaret's Land, and Emerald, Silverlode comprised the thoroughly inaccurately labeled Carisian Archipelago. Silverlode itself was even more sparsely settled than Carris, mostly because of its terrain, which was considered rugged even by Safeholdian standards. What population there was tended to be clustered along the long western coastline, sheltered from the dreadful storms which all too often blew in off the Carter Ocean to the southeast. Most of the Silverlode towns, cities, and petty nobles, although nominally independent of the Carisian crown, owed personal fealty of one sort or another to King Harald and his house, and, for all practical purposes, they were an integral part of the kingdom he ruled. It had taken Carris centuries of patient effort to attain her present position, but today she was the unquestioned mistress of Safehold's oceans. Her merchant marine was the largest on the entire planet, by a very considerable margin. Her navy was at least equal to that of any 2 of her potential rivals, and her wealth reflected that. Yet for all that, Carris was not quite in the top rank of Safehold's great powers. In many respects, she hovered on the cusp of crossing over to that status, but for the present, she was definitely not in the same league as the densely populated Harchong Empire, or the Republic of Sidermark, or the Desnarian Empire. Or, of course, the Temple Lands. Fortunately for Carris, none of those great powers, with the possible exception of the Desnarians, had any extensive naval tradition or, for that matter, ambitions. Unfortunately for Carris, the League of Coruscant, to the east of Emerald and Silverlode, and the steadily unifying Corsair Kinglets of Trellheim, even farther to the east, most certainly did. For that matter, so did the Kingdom of Chisholm, which dominated the somewhat larger continent of the same name, not to mention the Kingdom of Dolar and the Kingdom of Tarot. The latter might be an official ally of long standing, but its present monarch resented the arrangement. Not without some reason, since he found himself virtually a tributary vassal of Harald's. Oh yes. There were lots of people who had their own reasons for resenting, envying, hating, or fearing Carris, including, unfortunately, the Church. Merlin frowned at that thought, watching the busy harbor unseeingly while he contemplated it. He remained unable, or at least unwilling, to risk inserting his snark's listening devices into the temple's precincts. There was simply too much danger that those unidentified power sources might connect to something he really, really didn't want to disturb. But that meant that the one set of meetings he most longed to snoop upon, those of the Council of Vicars, were beyond his reach. He could operate a bit more freely in Zion, farther away from the temple, but it wasn't the same, because virtually all of the vicars, the Church of God's equivalent of the College of Cardinals, lived in the temple itself, in the vast, comfortable suites which were part of the original structure. Lesser prelates, like Carus's own Archbishop Eraic, had luxurious lodgings elsewhere in the city, and Merlin was able to listen in on their conversations in the restaurants, coffee houses, gaming houses, and discreet brothels where much of their business was conducted. He was well aware of the advantages that gave him, but it also made his lack of access inside the temple even more irritating. From what he could pick up, however, it was obvious the church cherished long-standing suspicions about Carus, and he sometimes suspected that dim memories of Shanwei's initial sponsorship of Telesburg still lingered. Whether that was so or not, the kingdom's distance from the temple and Zion would probably have been enough to make the church wary of its doctrinal reliability, and the local clergy was accustomed to a sort of benign neglect. When it took 2 months for the temple to send a message to Telesburg and receive a reply, there was simply no way the Council of Vicars could keep the local church as firmly under thumb as it could the clergy of Haven and Howard. From what Merlin had been able to discover, fears of Carisian heresy were unfounded, but Carisian attitudes were increasingly, if quietly, critical of the vicars' flagrant abuses of power. No one was going to be stupid enough to say so openly. The Inquisition operated even here, after all, which made it difficult for even Merlin to judge what sort of resentment simmered beneath the surface. But it was enough to bring at least some softly spoken criticism out of the church's own clergy here in the kingdom, which probably did amount to heresy in the vicar's eyes, Merlin admitted. And it was obvious that the kingdom's steadily growing wealth and international prestige was another factor in the disfavor with which Mother Church regarded Carus. But while there were many people prepared to resent or envy Carus, there were relatively few, with the probable exception of Gregor Stonar, Lord Protector of Sidermark, effectively the elective dictator of the Republic, who felt any particular urge to help the kingdom. And Sidermark, unfortunately, despite the well-deserved reputation of its matchless, pike-armed infantry, had no navy beyond a purely coast defense force which Narmon of Emerald could handily have defeated all by himself. All in all, Carus's future looked rather bleak. Not today. Not this 5 day, or possibly even next year, or the year after. But her enemies were drawing the noose steadily tighter about her with what amounted to the church's tacit approval. So far, Harald's canny diplomacy had managed to stave off outright disaster, but his enemies' recent success in having Taddeo Montale's claim to the Earldom of Honth confirmed over that of Howard Braegart marked a serious downturn in his fortunes. Honth was the largest of the feudal territories of Margaret's Land, and the one which had longest resisted Carisian authority. Having it handed to what everyone recognized, whether they were willing to admit it or not, as a usurper with no legitimate claim to the title, would have been a blow to Harald at any time. At this particular time, that blow might well prove mortal, or at least the first of the 1,000 cuts his enemies had in mind for him. By Merlin's current estimate, it was likely Harald would manage to pass his throne and crown to Caleb. It was unlikely Caleb would ever pass them to a son or daughter of his own, unless something changed. Merlin straightened, folding his arms as he watched the busy shipping along the wharves and docks of Tellisburg. There was power and vitality in Karras. Harchung was decadent, Desnair was too focused on conquest, and Sidermark was too preoccupied with securing its own frontiers against the threat of Harchung and Desnair alike. But Karras? There was wealth, art, and literature in Karras. In many ways, the kingdom reminded Merlin of what Nimmu had read of Old Earth's England in the 17th or 18th centuries, or perhaps Holland of roughly the same time period. There were no burgeoning scientists, for the Church of God Awaiting would never have permitted that. But at the same time, it was obvious to Merlin that Langhorne's plan had begun to slip, if ever so slightly. The critical, challenging mindset of Old Earth's scientific revolution might not have arisen yet, but that didn't mean all advances had been frozen. Here in Karras, for example, there was a yeasty, bubbling ferment, and the Royal College Harald's father had founded had gathered together a body of truly formidable scholars. It might be true that none of them had ever heard of the scientific method, but they were deeply devoted to the collection and preservation of knowledge, as well as teaching, and the present king had begun quietly appointing some of his kingdom's best mechanics to the college's fellows. The college's collective work helped foster a sense of opening horizons in applied techniques as well as the traditional humanities, which extended to other aspects of the kingdom's life. Like the burgeoning industrial base, of sorts at least, which underlay much of its growing wealth. The Holy Writ's prescriptions against any sort of advanced technology were unchallenged, even in Karras, but there'd already been a certain amount of leakage. Safeholdian metallurgy, for example, was at the level of Old Earth's early 18th century, or even a bit further advanced. And the planet's agriculture, built around the teaching of the Archangel Sondheim, disc arrows, animal-drawn reapers, and terrestrial food crops genetically engineered for disease and parasite resistance, not to mention high yields, was productive enough to create a surplus labor force. It wasn't that huge a surplus, as a percentage of the total population, especially not in places like Harchung, where the social structure had stratified centuries ago around a serf-based agricultural economy. It still took a lot of farmers to keep people fed. But there were a lot of artisans almost everywhere as well, and the situation was even worse, from Langhorne's perspective, here in Karras, whose climate permitted year-round agriculture in much of the island. Karras was a land with a sparse population and a widespread trading empire. Those factors had conspired to create a degree of inventiveness which would have horrified Langhorne and Bedard, and the Royal College's interest in the mechanical arts had begun to shape and direct that inventiveness. That thought alone would have been enough to incline Merlin favorably towards Karras, and to explain the church's suspicions of it, even if it hadn't suited the kingdom so well to his needs. If any of Langhorne's sycophants had studied history the way Shan Wei had, he suspected, the writ would have incorporated far more stringent controls on things like the use of water power. But they appeared to have overlooked the fact that Old Earth's industrial revolution had begun with water wheels, not steam engines, and Karras's manufactories were well on the road towards the same destination. Nor was that the only thing which had slipped through the cracks of Langhorne's great plan. These people had gunpowder, for example. It wasn't very good gunpowder. It was still meal powder, weak and dangerous to work with, and they hadn't had it very long, but he rather suspected that the gunpowder genie alone would have been enough to topple Langhorne's neat little scheme, eventually. Merlin wondered exactly how its introduction had gotten past the church. He suspected that the answer was a fairly massive bribe, probably from Harchung, where it had originally been introduced. Approving it for any reason struck Merlin as an act of lunacy on the church's part, given the system it was dedicated to maintaining. But in fairness, the church might not well have recognized its military potential when it first arrived. As nearly as Merlin could tell so far, it had been introduced primarily for use in mining and engineering projects, not warfare. And even now, 80 or 90 years later, it was obvious Safehold was still feeling its way towards the compound's military applications. At the moment, their firearms and artillery were about as primitively designed as their gunpowder. The best infantry firearm they had was a crudely designed matchlock, and no one appeared to have even thought of the wheel lock yet, much less the flintlock. Their artillery wasn't much more advanced conceptually, but that wasn't because their metallurgy wasn't good enough to produce much better weapons, assuming someone were to suggest how that might be done. Coupled with the Carizians' manufacturing base, general inventiveness, and tightening circle of enemies, that offered all sorts of possibilities for opening the nascent cracks in Langhorne's foundations just a bit wider. But even more importantly, there was a social openness in the kingdom of Karis as well. No one would ever confuse Karis with a representative democracy. King Harald would probably suffer an apoplectic attack at the very notion. But the Royal Carizian Navy had a centuries-long tradition of accepting only the service of freemen. Outright serfdom had been abolished in Karis well over a century ago, and by the standard of any other Safeholdian state, Carizian commoners were undeniably uppity. Which, coupled with the centrality of trade and traders to Carizian prosperity, helped explain why Harald's parliament was an active, vital part of his government. For the most part, it did what it was told, but it zealously guarded its prerogatives, and Harald was wise enough to side with the commons against the lords sufficiently often to leave no doubt in anyone's mind where the true power lay. For that matter, most of the Carizian nobility was actively involved in trade, without the arrogant hauteur of the landed nobles of Harchong or Desnare. They recognized ability as being just as vital as blue blood. The mere possession of a title did not excuse sloth or indolence, and a Carizian commoner of ability and energy could expect to rise far higher than his counterpart in almost any other Safeholdian realm. That was why Merlin was here. The basic matrix of Carizian politics and society offered the most fertile soil for the seed he had to plant. There was still the minor problem of Langhorne's insurance policy, which Owl had discovered in his orbital survey. Figuring out a way to deal with that was going to be a challenge. But even after it was overcome, it was obvious to Merlin that he couldn't possibly try to impose technology upon Safehold any more than he could single-handedly overthrow the church. The changes he had to induce must be organic, must grow out of a genuine shift in basic attitudes and belief structures. Merlin had come to think of himself as a virus. The analogy wasn't perfect, but it worked. By himself, he could accomplish nothing. But if he found the proper cell, invaded it, made it over in the necessary image, it would spread the infection for him, and Karis was the perfect host. Assuming, of course, that he could prevent its destruction. Fortunately, he continued to share one common trait with Nemu Alban. Both of them had always liked a challenge. 5. Royal Palace, Erastor, Emerald Island.
"What's so damned important?" Prince Narmon demanded in a surly tone.
The prince wore a light robe of Harchong cotton silk over his pajamas, and his expression was not happy as Hal Shandir, the 5th Baron of Shandir, was shown into his breakfast parlor. Narmon, as every male of the House of Bates seemed to be, was short. Unlike his late father, however, he was also a corpulent man, with a round baby face, which was capable of beaming with the simple joy of human kindness whenever its owner required it to. At such times, the casual observer might be forgiven for failing to note the hard, calculating light which burned behind its apparently mild brown eyes. At other times, like now, Narman's expression was a clear warning that he was in a foul mood. And when that was true, no one would have called his eyes mild.
"I crave your pardon for disturbing you so early, my prince," Shander replied, bending in a deep and profound bow. "I wouldn't have done so had the situation not required your immediate attention."
Narman grunted. The sound managed to combine dubiousness and irritation in almost equal measure, Shander noted unhappily. Narman hated having his leisurely breakfast routine interrupted by business, especially when the business in question included things he wasn't going to like hearing about. And there were very few bits of news, Shander knew, which he was going to be less happy to hear about over the post-breakfast pastries. On the other hand, the Prince of Emerald recognized Shander's value. And however irritable and demanding Narman could be, he also recognized the value of loyalty. Unpleasant scenes were far from rare for those unfortunates who found themselves bringing him bad news, but in the long run, he was a craftsman who cared for his tools, and he didn't really have the messenger beheaded. Not often, at any rate. The prince looked at him for several moments, keeping him standing. That wasn't a particularly good sign in Shandir's experience, but it wasn't necessarily a disastrous one either. The baron stood as calmly as he could under his prince's scrutiny, waiting. Morning breeze blew gently through the wide, open window, stirring the sheer drapes, and the luxuriously furnished room was quiet enough that Shandir could hear the rattle of near-palm fronds and the twittering of birds from the palace gardens, the more distant whistle of wyverns from the palace mews, and the occasional zinging whine of a spider beetle as it droned past the window. Then the prince snapped his fingers at the servant standing behind his chair.
"A cup of chocolate for the baron,"
he said, and the footman produced cup and chocolate pot as if by magic. Narman pointed at a chair at the foot of his table, and Shandir seated himself and waited, with carefully hidden relief, until the cup arrived in front of him.
"Leave the pot," Narman directed the servant.
"Yes, sire," the man murmured.
He set the pot at Shandir's elbow, then bowed himself out of the room. That was one thing about Narman's servants, Shandir reflected as he sampled the delicious chocolate. They were well-trained and knew the value of discretion.
"All right," Narman said as the dining parlor door closed behind the servant. "I don't imagine you came this early calling to bring me good news."
"I'm afraid not, my prince," Shandir admitted.
In fact, the baron would vastly have preferred to wait. Unfortunately, while Narman was never in a good mood when business interrupted his morning routine, he would have been in an even worse mood whenever he eventually discovered that Shandir had delayed bringing him this particular bit of information.
"Well, spit it out," Narman commanded.
"My prince, we've received a report from Lahang. Caleb is still alive."
Narman's round, chubby face tightened, and his eyes narrowed ominously. Shandir, as the man ultimately responsible for the planning and execution of all of Narman's clandestine operations, had seen that expression on several occasions, and he ordered his own expression to remain calm.
"Why?"
Narman asked coldly.
"Lahang wasn't certain when he wrote his report, my prince," Shandir replied,
reminding himself that he and his network of agents succeeded in Narman's service far more often than they failed.
"As you know," he added delicately, "Lahang wasn't completely free of constraints when he organized the assassination."
Narman's lips tightened further for just an instant, but they relaxed, and he nodded curtly. He knew exactly why Shandir had raised that point, but the semi-excuse had more than a little validity, and he recognized that as well.
Granted, the prince said after a moment. On the other hand, I thought the people he'd chosen were supposed to be professionals. They were, my prince, Shandir said. At least, they came highly recommended, and under the circumstances I have to agree with Lahang, and for that matter with the Duke, that using any of our own people would have been unwise.
Not if they'd succeeded,
Narman growled, but then he shook his head. In fairness, Lahang had been against the operation from the outset, and not just because of the tactical difficulties of arranging it. But the Duke had convinced Narman to overrule his agent on the spot, and Lahang hadn't been picked for that assignment at random. The fact that he'd initially opposed the attempt to kill Caleb wouldn't have kept him from doing his very best to make the assassination succeed. And given the way things seemed to have worked out, he'd obviously been right about the need to maintain the greatest possible degree of deniability on Emerald's part.
No. You're right, Hal, he conceded at last. Even if they'd succeeded, they might have been taken, made to talk.
From Lahang's report, it sounds as if at least one of them was taken, my prince, Shandir said.
Narman grimaced, and his spymaster shrugged.
At the moment, it appears unlikely the fellow knows much about who hired him. It sounds as if he was one of the common swordsmen.
Thank Langhorne for small favors, Narman muttered, then inhaled deeply.
What went wrong? He asked in a calmer tone, reaching for his own chocolate cup and sipping with a delicacy which always seemed a bit odd in someone as rotund as he.
Lahang is still working on the details, Shandir gave another small shrug. Obviously he has to be particularly careful just now. Suspicion in Telisberg has been running high, and Wave Thunder's going to be looking very carefully at anyone who seems to be poking around for information at a time like this. From the preliminary reports and rumors he'd been able to pick up before dispatching his message, though, it sounds like something out of a children's tale.
Narman's eyebrows arched, and Shandir chuckled humorlessly.
According to Lahang, the story going around in Telisberg is that the assassins almost succeeded, that they would have succeeded if not for the intervention of some mysterious stranger.
Stranger? Narman repeated.
That's what Lahang says, my prince. So far, there aren't any reliable details on just who this stranger might be, but the gossip running around Telisberg already has him bigger than life. Some of the wilder tales insist he's some sort of Sajin, probably with a magic sword to boot. But almost all of the rumors, even the more reasonable ones, agree it was he who warned Caleb and his bodyguards at the very last moment. The attacker still managed to kill or wound all of Caleb's guards, but between them, Caleb, his guardsmen, and this stranger killed all but one of the assassins. Most of the gossip agrees that the stranger killed over half of them himself.
It sounds like we should have hired him, Narman observed with bleak humor, and Shandir allowed himself a small smile in response.
The prince sat back in his chair, nibbling on a pastry rich with nuts and sticky with honey, while he considered Shandir's report. Shandir often wondered how the man could savor such sweet, heavy treats, given the climate of a sea-level capital city almost directly upon the equator. But Narman's sweet tooth was proverbial. He chewed thoughtfully, steadily, for at least 5 full minutes, and the Baron sat equally silent, sipping his own chocolate. Finally, Narman finished the pastry, wiped its stickiness from his fingers with a napkin, and drained his own cup.
"I assume you've told me everything we know so far?" he said.
"I have, my prince. As I've said, Lahang is working to get us more details, and I expect we'll hear from the Duke eventually."
This time he and Narman grimaced at one another.
"Until then, however," the Baron continued, "we really know nothing."
"Granted. Still, If the rumours and gossip all insist this stranger, whoever the Shanwei he was responsible for whatever went wrong, I think we need to discover all we can about him. Somehow, I doubt he's just going to disappear. Not after saving the Crown Prince's life. You may well be right, my prince, but it's also possible he's no more than a common adventurer who was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time. If you truly believe that's likely, Hal, then perhaps I need a new chief spy, Norman snorted. I didn't say it was likely, my prince. I simply pointed out that it was possible, and it is. I agree that we need to discover all we can about him, especially how he may have learned about our plans ahead of time. At the same time, it's never wise to allow oneself to become too wedded to any set of assumptions before they can be confirmed or denied. A valid point, Norman conceded. Still, I want to know everything we can about him. Of course, my prince.
And I think we need to consider our own exposure, Norman continued. I know Lahang's links to the Duke are well hidden, but Wave Thunder's no fool, and well hidden isn't the same as invisible. Harald is bound to suspect us, and if they've figured out more than we think they have, they may know exactly who Lahang is and pull him in for questioning. How much damage can he do us if they do?
A great deal, I'm afraid, Shandir admitted. He's in charge of all our operations in Telesburg, and he coordinates almost all of our agents outside the capital as well. And although we never told him what our ultimate objectives might be, he's bound to have recognized, especially with the Duke's participation, that it was a direct attack on the monarchy, not just on Caleb. The Baron sighed. To be effective, he has to know enough, and be intelligent enough to be dangerous, my lord.
Should we consider his retirement?
I honestly don't know.
Shandir frowned, one fingertip tracing circles in a brilliant patch of sunlight on the table's waxed and polished surface as he thought about it.
I'm sure he has plans in place to quietly disappear at need, the Baron said after a few seconds. How good those plans may be is impossible to say, of course, especially from this distance. If the Carizians know or suspect who he really is, the chance of his managing to simply vanish probably isn't very good. They'd have to be prepared to pounce the instant he looked as if he might be trying to get out of town. Given the fact that it's what he knows that makes him dangerous to us, ordering him to try to leave Telesburg might be the worst thing we could do, if it did cause them to go ahead and arrest him for interrogation.
It would probably be simpler and safer to simply have him removed, my prince. That would be relatively straightforward, and there are enough Carizians we could hire through a proper intermediary to kill him for any number of ostensible reasons without implicating ourselves. But he is our chief agent in Cariz, and he's always been effective for us. Losing him and all of his contacts and background knowledge would be a serious blow. It would take months, probably years, for anyone else to develop the same capabilities and sources.
I know. But if Wave Thunder arrests him, we lose him anyway, with the added risk that they may be able to prove we were involved.
My prince, Harald needs no proof of your enmity, Shandir pointed out. From that perspective, what happens to Lahang is completely beside the point.
Not if it inspires him to respond in kind, Norman observed dryly.
Agreed, but if they aren't certain we were directly behind the attempt, they have to suspect everyone else as well. Hector might be on their list of suspects, for example. Even Mantell could have been responsible for it. If Wave Thunder has connected Lahang to us, then killing him would probably convince them we were the primary movers. After all, if we weren't, why would we want to remove him?
Decisions, decisions. Norman sighed. There is one other aspect to consider, my prince, Shandir said. Norman looked at him, then gestured for him to continue.
There's always the Duke to bear in mind, the spymaster pointed out. I don't trust his ultimate reliability any more than I feel sure he trusts ours, but he has had direct contact with Lahang. If Lahang is interrogated, the Duke is just as exposed as we are. And also right where Harald can get at him.
I feel confident he's keeping his own eye on Lahang, and that he has his own plans already in place to ensure Lahang never has the opportunity to betray him. Which means,
Narmin interrupted, that we can rely on his self-interest, he nodded.
That doesn't mean his plans will work, of course, but he's right there in Telisberg while we're 2,000 miles away.
Exactly, my prince, Shander nodded.
And if he should have Lahang killed, and if Wave Thunder hasn't identified Lahang as our agent, then any investigation would lead to the Duke before it led to us.
Narmin plucked at his lower lip, then nodded.
A good point, he agreed. I'd really prefer to tie off that particular loose end ourselves, if it becomes necessary. But I think we'll have to rely on the Duke to worry about that for us. Of course, that leaves the problem of the Duke himself, doesn't it?
Shandir's eyes widened ever so slightly at the prince's biting tone, and Narmin chuckled coldly.
It's not as if I've ever trusted him, Hal. And we both know that, even now, he could probably make some arrangement with Harald if it came to it, which, given how much he knows, could be unfortunate for our other arrangements in Karis.
My prince, Shandir began very carefully.
Are you suggesting...
He broke off, allowing the question to hover, and Narmin snorted.
Part of me would like nothing better. But no, he said. Not yet, at any rate. And at least, he smiled thinly and coldly, if the time does come, we already have our own man in place to do the job.
He considered for several more seconds, then sighed.
All right. I suppose that's about all we can decide right now. In the meantime, however, I want you to brief Travis and Garth as well.
Shandir nodded. Travis Olson, Earl of Pine Hollow, was Narmin's cousin and chief counselor, and Garth Ralston, the Earl of Mondeer, was the commander of the Emerald Navy.
Shall I brief them fully, my prince?
The Baron asked, arching one eyebrow, and Narmin frowned.
Tell Travis everything we know or suspect, he directed after a moment. Tell Garth we have to assume Harald will suspect we were involved, whether or not we actually were, and that I want him to be thinking about ways we can improve our own preparedness, just in case. Yes, my prince. In addition, I want you to put together reports for Thomas and Hector as well,
Narmin continued.
In Thomas's case, I'll write a letter of my own to go with it. For Hector, though, I think we'll just let you send your own report, purely as a professional courtesy, since we obviously don't have any first-hand information, to Corus.
Shandir nodded again. Grand Duke Tomas of Zebediah was the closest thing Prince Hector of Coruscant had to a rival for control of the League of Coruscant. Unfortunately for Tomas's dreams of glory, he wasn't very much of a rival, although he was the preeminent noble on the island of Zebediah and the hereditary leader of the Council of Zebediah. The entire island was firmly under Hector's thumb. Tomas functioned as little more than the governor of Zebediah in Hector's name, and however much he might aspire to greater heights, it was most unlikely he would ever attain them. Still, Narmin had been careful to cultivate the man. One never knew when one might need any counterweight one could get, after all. Philip Osgood, the Earl of Corus, on the other hand, was Shandir's own counterpart in Hector's service. Shandir had a lively respect for Corus's native ability, and he didn't for a moment think the Earl would believe Narmin hadn't been a primary mover behind the attempt on Caleb. Still, appearances had to be maintained, and Hector was scarcely likely to press the point as long as Narmin chose to maintain the fiction. After all, Hector wouldn't exactly have shed any tears if the assassins had succeeded.
"Of course, my prince,"
he murmured aloud, and Narmin grunted in satisfaction.
"In that case, I think you should probably be on your way," he said,
and Shandir rose, bowed respectfully, and backed his way out of the dining parlor. Neither he nor his prince had noticed the almost microscopic insect hanging from the ceiling above the table. Even if they had noticed it, they would have paid it no attention, of course, for neither of them had ever heard of something called a snark, and certainly not of the remote sensors one of them could deploy.
6. Royal Palace, Telesburg, Kingdom of Karas.
Sejin Merlin, Your Majesty,
the Chamberlain said quietly as he stepped through the open doorway and bowed. Merlin followed him into the small presence chamber, more of a working office, really, it seemed, and bowed a bit more profoundly than the Chamberlain. King Harald's court was looked down upon by the courtiers of such sophisticated lands as Harchong because of its casual informality and ability to get along without a veritable horde of servitors. Still, Harald was a king, and one of the more powerful ones on the face of Safehold, whatever others might think.
Sejin,
Harald said, and Merlin looked up. He saw a man of middle years, stocky for a Carisian, and taller than most, although shorter than his son and considerably shorter than Merlin. Harald wore the traditional loose-cut breeches and thigh-length linen overtunic of the Carisian upper class, although his tunic was bright with bullion embroidery and beadwork. The belt about his waist was made of intricately decorated seashell-shaped plaques of hammered silver, the golden scepter badge of one who'd made his required pilgrimage to the temple gleamed on his shoulder brooch, and the glittering fire of the emerald-set golden chain, which was his normal badge of office, glowed upon his chest. He had a neatly trimmed beard, somewhat more luxuriant than Merlin's own, and the slight epicanthic fold common to most of Safehold's humanity. Harald the Seventh was 52 local years old, just over 47 standard, and he'd sat on his throne for just over 20 local years. In that time, he'd come to be known, by his own subjects at least, as Harald the Just, and his level eyes considered Merlin thoughtfully. He was putting on a bit of extra flesh these days, Merlin noticed. Judging from his chest and shoulders, he'd been a man of heroic physique in his youth, but maintaining that sort of fitness, especially at his age, must have been the next best thing to impossible given his immobile right knee. His leg stretched out straight in front of him, his heel resting on a footrest, as he sat in a comfortable but not particularly splendid armchair behind a desk cluttered with documents and slates. One other person was present. A bishop of the Church of God Awaiting, with silvering dark hair and a splendid patriarchal beard, stood at the king's right shoulder. His three-cornered cap bore the white cockade of a senior bishop, but lacked the ribbon of an archbishop. His eyes were bright, as they considered Merlin, and his white cassock bore the oil lamp emblem of the Order of Bedard. The sight of that lamp set Merlin's teeth instantly on edge, but he made himself suppress the instinctive reaction firmly. Much as he hated to admit it, the order which bore Adori Bedard's name had changed over the years into something far different from anything its ostensible patron would have wanted to see. Besides, he'd seen this bishop often enough through his snarks to strongly suspect what impelled Harald to trust him so totally. Your Majesty, he murmured in reply to the king's greeting after only the briefest of pauses. You do me honor to receive me privately.
Perhaps, Harald said, studying his visitor intently. Some might feel I've slighted you by not greeting you and thanking you for my son's life in a more public audience.
But at that more public audience, Your Majesty, I would undoubtedly have been uncomfortably aware of all the spanned crossbows watching me so alertly. Here, Merlin smiled charmingly, I need worry only about the two bodyguards behind that screen. He nodded towards the exquisitely detailed lacquered Harchongese screen behind the king, and Harald's eyes narrowed. The bishops, however, only considered Merlin with a sort of calm curiosity. Interesting, Merlin thought, but his attention was mainly focused on the king, waiting for his reaction, which came after a heartbeat in a single word.
Indeed, Harald said,
and Merlin smiled again. This is Thursday, Your Majesty. Assuming you've stuck to your regular duty schedule, it should be Sergeant Harpar and Sergeant Gardiner. The chamberlain stepped quickly to one side, right hand falling to the dagger sheathed at his hip. The bishop touched the golden scepter of Langhorne hanging upon his breast, and even Harald sat up straighter in his chair. But the king also raised one hand and shook his head sharply at the chamberlain.
"No, Powell," he said. "After all, our guest is a Sajin, is he not?" "Or something else, sire," the chamberlain said darkly.
He glowered at Merlin with eyes full of suspicion, and his hand left his dagger hilt only reluctantly. "Your Majesty," Merlin said, "my weapons have all been left in my chamber. Your guardsmen were extremely courteous, but they also searched me very carefully before permitting me into your presence. Surely one unarmed man is no threat to a monarch whose servants are as loyal to him as yours are to you."
"Somehow, Sajin Merlin, I doubt a man such as you is ever unarmed, as long as he has his brain,"
Harald said with a slow, appreciative smile of his own. "One tries, Your Majesty," Merlin conceded. The bishop's lips twitched in what might almost have been a stillborn smile, and Harald leaned back in his chair once more, considering the blue-eyed stranger even more thoughtfully than before. Then he nodded and looked at the chamberlain.
"Powell, I believe we might offer Sajin Merlin a chair."
Powell Hallman looked moderately outraged, but he also carried a straight-backed but upholstered chair from the corner of the room and set it down facing Harald's desk.
"Please, Sajin," Harald invited. "Be seated."
"Thank you, Your Majesty." Merlin settled into the chair and cocked his head, his eyebrows raised.
"Yes, Sajin," Harald said with a suspiciously grin-like smile, "the interrogation will now begin."
"I'm at your service, Your Majesty." Merlin inclined his head again, politely, and Harald chuckled.
"I find that difficult to believe, Sajin," he said. "Somehow I have the distinct impression that it's more a case of Caris finding herself at your service."
Merlin smiled, but behind that smile he winced. Harald the Seventh, in person, was even more impressive than he'd been observed from afar via Snark.
"Before we begin," Harald said more seriously, "allow me to extend my personal thanks for your intervention on Caleb's behalf. Without you, he would be dead, and for that, I and my house stand in your debt. How may I reward you?"
"Your Majesty," Merlin said with matching seriousness, "while I'm sure some token of your gratitude is in order, it might be as well to draw as little attention to me as possible."
"And why might that be?" Harald asked.
"Because I'll be far more useful to Caris if my presence here doesn't become general knowledge."
"And why should you care to be of use to me?"
"Your pardon, Your Majesty," Merlin said almost gently, "but I didn't say of use to you. I said of use to Caris. The two are closely related, but not, I fear, identical."
"The king is the kingdom!"
Hallman snapped, then flushed darkly as he realized he'd spoken out of turn. But despite the flush, there was no hiding the fresh anger in his eyes. "No, my Lord Chamberlain," Merlin disagreed. "The king is the heart and soul of the kingdom, but he is not the kingdom itself. Were that true, then the kingdom would perish with his death."
"The church teaches that king and crown are one," the bishop observed, speaking for the first time, and his voice and expression were both carefully neutral.
"And I don't dispute that point with the church, Bishop Michael," Merlin said, and the priest's head cocked to one side as the stranger named him correctly. "I simply observe that the king who is the heart of the kingdom isn't merely a single individual, but all individuals who hold that office and discharge those duties in the name of the kingdom. And so, while the king and the kingdom are one, the mortal man who holds that office is but one man in an endless chain of men who hold their crowns in trust for those they are charged to guard and protect."
Harald glanced up at Bishop Michael,
then returned his attention to Merlin and gazed at him without speaking for the better part of a full minute. Finally, he nodded slowly.
"A valid distinction," he said. "Not one all monarchs would agree with, but one I can't dispute."
"And the fact that you can't, Your Majesty, is the reason I'm here," Merlin said simply. "While all kings may be ordained by God, all too few prove worthy of their coronation oaths. When one sees the visions which I've been given to see, that fact becomes sadly evident."
"Ah, yes, those visions of yours."
Harald pursed his lips, then chuckled and raised his voice slightly.
"Charles, you and George may as well come out and join us."
A moment later, the lacquered screen shifted to one side, and two Royal Guard sergeants stepped out from behind it. Both wore black cuirasses, the breastplates emblazoned with the golden kraken of Garrus. They also carried spanned, steel-bowed arbalests, and they regarded Merlin warily as they took their places at their king's back.
"I must admit," Harald said, "that I found your performance rather impressive, Sajin Merlin. As, no doubt, you intended I should. Of course, it's always possible sufficiently good spies could have provided you with that information. On the other hand, if my personal household is that riddled with spies, my house is already doomed. So, since you obviously want me to ask the question, I will. How did you know?"
Despite his whimsical tone, his brown eyes sharpened, and he leaned slightly forward in his chair. "Your Majesty," Merlin replied, "these three men," he waved one hand, taking in the two guardsmen and the chamberlain, "are, I believe, loyal unto death to you, your son, and your house. I trust them as fully as I trust you yourself. And Bishop Michael has been your confessor for, what, 15 years now? But while what I'm about to tell you may prove difficult to believe, I hope to be able to offer you proof I speak the truth. And I believe that if I can prove that to you, you'll understand why it must be kept as secret as possible for as long as possible." He paused, and the king nodded without even glancing at his retainers. The three of them continued to regard Merlin with wary eyes, but Merlin saw how their shoulders straightened and their expressions firmed at the king's obvious confidence in their trustworthiness. Bishop Michael simply moved a half-step closer to Harald's chair and rested one large, powerful hand lightly on its back. "As I'm sure Prince Caleb and Lieutenant Falcon have already told you, Your Majesty," he began, "I've lived for many years in the Mountains of Light, and in the process I've developed some, though far from all, of the reputed powers of the Seijin. It isn't a title I would lightly claim for myself, yet it may be that it fits. At any rate, it's been given to me to see visions of distant places and events, to hear the voices of distant people. It's as if an invisible bird perched on the wall there," he pointed at a spot on the plastered wall not far from an open window, "or on the branch of a tree, and I saw through its eyes, heard through its ears. I've never seen the future, and I can't call up the past. I only see the present, and no man can see all that transpires everywhere in the entire world. But the things which I have seen have focused more and more tightly upon Karras, upon your house, and upon Caleb. I don't believe that would happen by accident." Harald's eyes seemed to bore into Merlin's. The King of Karras had a reputation for being able to pull the truth out of any man, but Merlin gazed back levelly. After all, everything he'd said was completely truthful. If 8 standard centuries at the same address didn't count as living for many years in the Mountains of Light, he couldn't imagine what would. And his visions had focused more and more upon Karras, and definitely not by accident.
"What sorts of visions?" Harald asked after a long, still moment. "Of whom?"
"As I've said, I see and hear as if I were physically present. I can't read a page if it isn't turned. I can't hear a thought if it isn't spoken. I can't know what passes in the secret places of someone's heart,
only what they say and do. I've seen visions of you, Your Majesty. I've seen you in this chamber with your personal guards, seen you with Chamberlain Hallman. I've seen you discussing the Hanth succession with Caleb and matters of policy with Earl Greyharbor. I saw and heard you discussing the new patrols off Tritonhead with High Admiral Lock Island when you instructed him to reinforce Falcon and Warrior with Rockshoal Bay and her entire squadron. Harald had been nodding slowly, but he froze abruptly at the mention of Lock Island. Not surprisingly, Merlin thought, given that he and the High Admiral had discussed those reinforcements, and the reasons for them, under conditions of maximum security. None of their precautions, however, had been directed at a snark which could deploy reusable parasite spy bugs. "I've seen visions of Caleb," Merlin continued, "not just in conversation with you, but riding to the hunt with his arms master, even at his books." Merlin smiled slightly and shook his head at that. "And I've seen him sitting in council with you, and on shipboard. And just as I've seen those visions, I've seen your people. I told Caleb that what I've seen gives me a good opinion of you, Your Majesty, and it does. In all honesty, and without seeking to curry favor with you, I haven't been given a vision of any other king of Safehold who comes as close as you do to the ideal the Church proclaims. You aren't perfect. Indeed, if you'll forgive me, you're far from it. But you also know you aren't, and, perhaps even more importantly, you've taught your heir to know the same thing. Those qualities, that sense of responsibility, are too rare and precious for me to see them lightly cast aside. I believe the reason I've seen what I've seen has been to bring me here to offer my services, such as they are, to the preservation of this kingdom and the tradition of service its monarchs strive to uphold."
"The praise of the praiseworthy is especially welcome," Harald said, after another long, thoughtful pause. "I trust you'll forgive me, however, for pointing out that praise and flattery sometimes blur."
"Especially when the one offering them desires something," Merlin agreed. "And, to be honest, Your Majesty, I do desire something." Harald's eyes narrowed, and Merlin smiled. "I desire to see Karis become all she may become," he said.
"All she may become," Harald repeated. "Why, Karis? Even if everything you've said about my myriad good qualities were accurate, why pick this kingdom? It can't be because of any sense of loyalty to my house, since the one thing you obviously aren't is a Carisian. So, if you'll forgive me, Sajin Merlin, it must be because of something you want out of Karis. Some goal or objective of your own. And while I'm deeply grateful for your part in saving my son's life, and although only a fool could fail to recognize the value of an advisor who sees what you appear to see, no king worthy of his crown could accept such services without knowing what you want is also what he wants."
Merlin leaned back in his own chair, gazing thoughtfully at the Carisian monarch, then nodded mentally. Harald the Seventh was just as tough-minded as Merlin had expected, but there was a hard core of honesty close to the king's surface. This was a man who could play the game of deception, of bluff and counterbluff, with the best of them, but it wasn't the game he preferred. Of course, it remained to be seen if Bishop Michael was equally tough-minded and resilient. Normally, Merlin wouldn't have been very optimistic about that where a bishop of the Church of God Awaiting was concerned, but Michael was hardly typical of the breed. For one thing, the king's confessor was a Carisian. So far as Merlin had been able to determine, he'd never left the kingdom in his entire life, except to make his own pilgrimage to the temple, and he was the highest-ranking native Carisian in the entire archbishopric's hierarchy. Harald's choice, 10 years before, of Michael Stainer to be Bishop of Telisburg, as well as his confessor, had not been popular with Archbishop Erech's predecessor. But Harald had clung stubbornly to his prerogative to nominate the priest of his choice to the capital see. and over the years, Michael had become a member of the king's inner circle of advisors, which could be a good thing or a very bad thing indeed. "Your Majesty," Merlin said finally, "why did your great-grandfather abolish serfdom here in Caris?" Harald frowned, as if surprised by the question. Then he shrugged.
"Because it's what he believed God wanted of us," he said.
"But serfdom exists in Emerald," Merlin pointed out, "and in Taro, Coruscant, and Chisholm. In Harchong, the lot of a serf is little better than that of a beast of the field. Indeed, they treat their draft animals better than they do their serfs, because those animals are more expensive, and in Desnair and Trelheim, they practice outright slavery. Even in the Temple Lands," he looked up from the king's face to meet Bishop Michael's eyes with just a hint of challenge, "men are bound to the land of the great church estates, although they aren't called serfs. Yet not here. Why not? You say it's not what God wants of you, but why do you believe that?"
"The writ teaches that God created every Adam and every Eve in the same instant, the same exercise of his will through the Archangel Langhorne," Harald said. "He didn't create kings first, or nobles, or wealthy merchants. He breathed the breath of life into the nostrils of all men and all women. Surely that means all men and all women are brothers and sisters. We may not be born to the same states in this later, less perfect world. Some of us are born kings now, and some are born noble or to wealth, or all three. Yet those born more humbly are still our brothers and sisters. If God sees men that way, then so must we. And if that's true, then men aren't cattle or sheep or horses or dragons, not something to be owned."
He half glared at Merlin, and Merlin shrugged. "And would you agree with that, Bishop Michael?" he asked quietly.
"I would."
The priest's voice was deep and powerful, well suited to preaching and prayer, and there was a glitter in his eyes. They weren't quite as hard as Harald's, but there was no retreat in them either, and Merlin nodded slowly. Then he looked back at the king. "Other rulers would appear to disagree with you, Your Majesty," he observed. "Even the church feels differently, to judge by her own practices in her own lands, at any rate. But you do believe it. And that, Your Majesty, is my goal, my objective. I believe the same thing you do, and I see no other powerful kingdom which does. I respect you, and in many ways I admire you. But my true loyalty," he shrugged once more, "that belongs not to you or to Caleb, but to the future. I will use you if I can, Your Majesty, use you to create the day in which no man owns another, no man thinks men born less nobly than he are cattle or sheep." Halman glared angrily at him, but Harald only nodded slowly, his expression thoughtful. "And that's the true reason I want Caris not simply to survive, but to prosper," Merlin said. "Not because I love empire, and not because I crave wealth, or because I confuse military might with the true strength of a kingdom, but while it may not be given to me to see the future, I know what future I would like to see. I know what values, what laws, what sort of monarchy I believe God wants called forth. And at this time, Your Majesty, Caris offers the best hope for the future I would like to see to ever come to pass. Which is why I said from the very beginning that I came not to serve you specifically, but to serve Caris, the idea of Caris, of her future." Harald drummed lightly on one arm of his chair with the fingers of his right hand, then glanced up at Bishop Michael.
"Michael," he said quietly.
"Sire," the bishop said without hesitation, "I can quarrel with nothing this man has said. I know your hopes, your aspirations, and I know what it is you most fear."
His fingers stroked his pectoral scepter again, apparently unconsciously, and his nostrils flared.
if I might, sire?
Harald nodded, and the bishop looked back at Merlin.
I've never met an actual Seijin, he said. Once in my life I met a man who claimed to be a Seijin, but what he was in reality was a charlatan.
Your Eminence, Merlin said when the bishop paused, I haven't claimed to be a Seijin. I've claimed only that I have some of the powers ascribed to a Seijin.
I observed that, Michael said with a small smile. Indeed, while I would never claim to be the equal of my esteemed colleagues in the temple as a theologian, I've engaged in my share of theological debate, and perhaps as a consequence of that, I was struck by several things you didn't say.
You were? Merlin's politely attentive expression never wavered, but internal alarms began to sound as the bishop gazed at him levelly for several seconds.
According to many of the tales I read when I was younger, Michael said finally, a true Seijin frequently is known only after the fact, by the nature of his deeds. Others may give him the title. He seldom claims it for himself. The nature of these visions of yours, however, will strike many as ample evidence that whatever else you may be, you are not as other mortal men. So, perhaps we can all agree, Seijin is the word best suited, for now at least, to describing whatever it is you are. But, having agreed to that, what are we to make of you and your purposes? That, I'm sure you will agree, is the critical question. And my answer to it is that the writ teaches that the true nature of any man will be shown forth in his actions. It matters not whether that man is a king, a merchant, a Seijin, or a peasant. In the end, he cannot conceal what he truly is, what he truly stands for. So far, you've saved Caleb's life. Whether or not God sent you to us for that specific purpose, I don't know. But, in my judgment, it was not the act of one who would serve darkness.
The bishop looked at his monarch and bent his head in a curiously formal little bow.
Your Majesty, he said, I sense no evil in this man. I may be wrong, of course. Unlike the Grand Vicar or the Chancellor, I'm merely a humble, unlettered provincial bishop. But my advice to you is to listen to him. I know the darkness which is settling about us. Perhaps this man and the services he offers are the lamp—
He touched the embroidered sigil of his order on the breast of his habit.
You require.
Had Merlin been a being of flesh and blood, he would have let out a long, quiet exhalation of relief. But he wasn't. And so he simply sat, waiting, while Harald looked deeply into his confessor's eyes. Then the king returned his attention to Merlin once again.
And how would you serve Corus? He asked intently.
With my visions, as they're given to me. With my sword, as I must. And with my mind, as I may. Merlin said simply. For example, I'm certain you've interrogated the one assassin we managed to take alive.
That you managed to take alive,
Harald corrected, and Merlin shrugged. Perhaps, Your Majesty, but while I've had no vision of his interrogation, as I say, I see much but not all, I do know who sent him. Halman and the two guardsmen leaned slightly forward, eyes intent. Bishop Michael's bearded lips pursed thoughtfully, and Merlin's smile was cold. "I know it must have been tempting to lay the blame on Hector of Coruscant," he said, "but in this case it would be an error. The men who attempted to kill Prince Caleb were mercenaries, Desnarians hired by Prince Narmon and certain others, but Prince Hector wasn't even consulted, so far as I'm aware. Which isn't to say he isn't involved in plots of his own. Indeed, his objection to your assassination, Your Majesty, or Caleb's, is purely tactical, not a matter of any sort of personal qualm. From what he's said to his own closest advisers and servants, and what I've read of his letters to Narmon,
He simply believes assassins are unlikely to succeed, and, I think, fears how your kingdom might react if an attempt did succeed. He has no desire to meet you ship to ship at this time, not yet, and he believes that if Caleb were killed and you believed Coruscant was behind it, that's precisely what he would face, which is why he prefers to undermine your strength at sea in order to weaken you for a decisive blow by more conventional means. You once called him a sand maggot, not a slash lizard, when you and Caleb discussed him, and I believe it was an apt description. But in this case, the sand maggot is thinking in more conventional terms than his allies. Harald's eyes had grown more and more intent as he listened to Merlin. Now he sat back in his chair, his expression one of wonder.
Sejin Merlin, he said, when I summoned you to this audience, I didn't honestly expect to believe you. I wanted to, which is one reason I was determined not to. But the finest spies in the world couldn't have told you all you've just told me, and every word you've said has been accurate, so far as my own sources are able to confirm. I know someone who said what you've said here today will understand that, despite all of that, your sincerity and trustworthiness must be tested and proved. For myself, as an individual, as Harald Armark, I would trust you now. As King Harald of Caris, I can give no man the trust I must give you if I accept the services you offer until he be proven beyond question or doubt.
Your Majesty, Merlin said quietly, you're a king. It's your duty to remember men lie, that they deceive, and that often revealing a little truth makes the final deception all the more convincing. I don't expect you to accept my services, or even the truth of my visions, without testing thoroughly. And as you test, I beg you to remember this. I've said my service is to Caris, and what Caris may become, not to you personally. And I meant it. I'll give you all the truth that lies in me, and the best counsel I may. But in the end, my service, my loyalty, is to a future which lies beyond your life, beyond the lifespan of this person you call Merlin, and beyond even the lifespan of your son. I would have you understand that.
Sejin Merlin, I do.
Harald looked deep into those unearthly sapphire eyes, and his voice was soft.
It's said the Sejin serve the vision of God, not of man. That any man who accepts the advice of a Sejin had best remember the vision of God need not include his own success or even survival. But one of the duties of a king is to die for his people, if God requires it of him. Whatever God's vision for Caris may demand, I will pay. And if you are a true Sejin, if you truly serve his vision, that's more than sufficient for me, whatever my own future may hold.
7. Tellisberg and Stiven Mountains, Kingdom of Caris, Armageddon Reef. Merlin sat once more in his chamber. A humid, windless night pressed heavily against its window. Nemu Alban, born and raised in Old Earth's Nor Europe, would have found that night uncomfortably warm, despite the season. But Apika was unconcerned by such minor matters. Merlin was more struck by the moonless night's impenetrable blackness, which was still one of the most alien aspects of Safehold for the man whose mind had been Nemu Alban's. Nemu had been a child of a technological civilization, one of illumination, of light and energy that drove back the darkness and domed its cities in reflected cloud glow on the darkest of nights. Tellisberg was well lit for a city of Safehold, but the only illumination on this planet came from the simple flames of burning wood or wax, of tallow or oil, far too feeble to drive out the night. Like Tellisberg itself, Merlin's chamber was well lit by Safeholdian standards. It was illuminated not by candles, but by the fine, clear flame of lamps filled with kraken oil and equipped with the comparatively newfangled notion of polished reflectors, placed behind their chimneys to concentrate and direct their light. Despite that, the available light was scarcely sufficient for comfortable reading, especially of the intricate calligraphy in the hand-lettered volume on Merlin's desk. It could be done, and had been, by generations of Safehold-born humans, but not without a stiff penalty and eye strain. Merlin, however, had certain advantages. For one, his artificial eyes were immune to strain. They were also equipped with light-gathering technology, which made the room, and indeed the bottomless night outside it, daylight clear. He deleted the standard Pika 10-day countdown clock from his visual field, and there was nothing to distract him as he skimmed rapidly and steadily through the thick, leather-bound copy of the Holy Writ of the Church of God Awaiting. It was far from the first time he'd perused the writ, yet he found the book continually fascinating, in the way a homicide detective might have been fascinated by the autobiography of a sadistic serial killer he'd known as a boyhood friend. There were many aspects of its moral teachings with which Merlin could not take issue, however badly he wanted to. Maruyama Chihiro had borrowed heavily from existing religions, and the core of his writ's moral teachings would have been familiar to almost any Old Earth theologian. For the most part, Merlin reflected, that was undoubtedly inevitable, for a stable society required an underlying framework of rules and laws which those living within it accepted. Throughout human history, religion had been one of the primary wellsprings of that legitimacy, and it was that portion of the writ which produced priests like Bishop Michael. But the religions from which Maruyama had lifted his core commandments and moral precepts had been the product of a genuine effort to understand, or at least conceptualize, God or whatever higher power their adherents had sought. The Church of God Awaiting's seminal scripture wasn't. It was a deliberate fraud, perpetrated upon its followers by individuals whose actions had directly contradicted the principles and beliefs of the religions in which so many of them had been raised. It was a lie, using the hunger within human beings which had driven them to seek God by whatever name or in whatever form throughout the human race's entire history, not simply to control, but to program. To stifle any sense of inquiry which might threaten the fraudulent template Eric Langhorne and Adoree Bedard had manufactured to hammer any future human society into the pattern they had found good. Merlin had to admit that, between them, Langhorne, Bedard, and Maruyama had managed to kill quite a few birds with the single stone of the writ. He turned back to the beginning of the volume and grimaced as he glanced once more at the table of contents. The Book of Langhorne, the Book of Bedard, the Book of Pasquale, the Books of Sondheim, Truscott, Schuller, Zhuozheng, Chihiro, Andropov, Hastings. The list went on and on, each book attributed to one of the archangels. The writ contained no gospels written by mere mortals. Such human-produced writings existed, in the commentaries and the insights, not to mention the testimonies, which were also a part of the Church of God Awaiting's central scripture and authority. But none of those merely human writings could compare to the legitimacy and centrality of the writ, for unlike them, its every word had been handed down directly from the mouth of God through his immortal angels. The writ wasn't just an instrument of social control, either. True, the Book of Langhorne dealt with the law of God as taught by the Church of God Awaiting. Merlin had gagged mentally more than once as he waded through the love-cloaked half-truths and outright falsehoods from which Langhorne, or Maruyama, writing for Langhorne at any rate, had woven the straitjacket into which he'd laced the inhabitants of Safehold. And the Book of Bedard was at least as hard for Merlin to take, a masterpiece of psychology in the service of deception and mind control that rejoiced in the subtitle of The Book of Wisdom and Self-Knowledge. But
But many of its other books were, in fact, a practical guide to terraforming and the colonization of an alien planet. The Archangel Hastings' book, for example, was actually an atlas, a very detailed atlas of the entire planet, based upon the meticulous maps Shan Wei's crew had made at the time of its original terraforming. The maps in Merlin's copy of the writ were on far too small a scale to be very useful, and quite a bit of distortion had crept in when the printer's engravings were made, but the master maps had been carefully preserved in the temple. Indeed, those master maps were some of the church's holiest artifacts. The advanced synthetics of their paper were fireproof, waterproof, about as tough as a 5mm sheet of hammered copper, and virtually immune to the effects of age, all of which, of course, amply proved their miraculous nature. Almost equally importantly, however, the Book of Hastings required that copies of those maps be made available to the public as well as the church in the cathedral of every bishop. Safeholdians knew exactly what the geography of their world looked like, which had been of enormous importance when they set about deciding where to plant additional enclaves, and the writ's other books had given them a guide for how those enclaves were to be established. It was a guide that deliberately falsified the basis for many of the lessons it taught and the religious laws it handed down, but it had provided the basic framework under which humanity had expanded from its initial enclaves on this planet. The Book of Sondheim dealt with agronomy and farming, including, especially, the necessary steps to prepare safehold soil for the essential terrestrial plants humanity required. The Book of Truscott did the same thing for animal husbandry, for native Safeholdian species, as well as imports from Earth. The Book of Pasquale contained religious laws to provide sanitation, good hygiene and diet, the treatment of wounds, and basic preventive medicine. Even the Book of Bedard, despite the purpose for which it had been written, contained quite a lot of sound psychological advice and insight, and the members of her order, like Bishop Michael, had taken its precepts in very different directions from anything she might have intended. The order's successes in ministering to the mental and emotional needs of Safeholdian humanity were little short of amazing in many cases, and it was the Bedardites who administered the majority of the church's charitable works. Yet all of the writ's directives were couched as religious laws, proper rituals and sacrifices to be performed by the devout. The Book of Pasquale's injunctions never mentioned germs or the scientific basis on which his laws rested, for example, and if a healer failed to wash his hands in one of the holy waters properly prepared and blessed by a priest before treating a wound, and that wound became septic, or before delivering a baby, and that mother died of childbed fever, then it was not infection or disease which was to blame, but sin. And the maps of the Book of Hastings, which conclusively demonstrated that their world was a sphere, also explicitly taught Safeholdians the Ptolemaic theory of the universe, and turned gravity itself into yet another of the Archangel Langhorne's miraculous gifts to man through God's grace. Indeed, Langhorne had created the world as a round ball at the center of the crystal spheres of the moon, sun, stars, and God's own heaven expressly as a means to demonstrate to man that God could accomplish anything he willed. After all, did it not require an act of divine will and power to keep people from falling off the bottom side of the world and crashing into the moon? And so, in addition to providing the directions by which the original enclaves had followed the Archangel Langhorne's direction to be fruitful and multiply and inhabit the world God had given them, the writ had aided powerfully in the systematic abortion of anything resembling the scientific method, while simultaneously reinforcing the power of the Church as preceptor and governor of humanity. Then there were the Book of Zhuozheng and the Book of Schuller. Neither of them were as long as some of the others, but they went to the very heart of Langhorne's ultimate purpose here on Safehold.
Zhuo Zhang handed down the official descriptions and definitions of that technology which God found acceptable, and that which he rejected as unclean, or tainted, or reserved solely for his archangels and angels. And Schuller, whose book was both the shortest and the most horrifying of them all, defined the punishment to be visited upon those who violated the prescriptions of Langhorne and Zhuo Zhang. The thought that anyone raised in the same society as Nimmu Alban could have resurrected so many nightmares from the horrific closet of mankind's savagery to his own was enough to turn even Merlin's alloy and composite's stomach. Schuller must have spent endless hours poring over the history texts to come up with such a detailed catalog of atrocities to be visited upon the unbeliever in God's most holy name. But the most fascinating and infuriating of all, in many ways, was the Book of Chihiro, the book which had been added later, after the close of the original copy of the writ, which had been stored in the computers in Nimmu's cave. It seemed apparent that Pei Kao Yung's vengeance for his wife and friends had eliminated almost all of Langhorne's leadership cadre. Indeed, from the sudden dearth of angelic visitations recorded in the testimonies following his attack, it seemed likely he'd gotten a huge chunk of Langhorne's lower-level personnel as well. Unfortunately, Maruyama Chihiro hadn't been among the casualties, and he and his fellow survivors had managed to keep most of Langhorne's plan on track. The Archangel Chihiro, revered as the patron of personal protection and called the guardian of cities in the hagiography of the Church of God Awaiting, had been the official historian of God. He was the one who had recorded the miracle of Safehold's creation, and he was also the recorder of how Shan Wei, Dark Mother of Evil, had tainted the purity of that creation in the name of ambition and greed. Murayama had tied it all together well, Merlin thought bitterly. Shan Wei, brightest of all the Archangel Langhorne's assistants, had viewed Safehold not as a work of God which she had been privileged to help bring into existence, but as the work of her own hands. And from that hubris, that twisted sense of her own self-worth and that vaunting pride, had flowed all of the evil in Safehold. She had set herself against her rightful overlord, the Archangel Langhorne, and against God himself, and she'd gathered to herself the Archangel Proctor, who had opened the seals on temptation and forbidden knowledge. The Archangel Sullivan, who had taught humanity gluttony and self-indulgence. The Archangel Grimaldi, whose twisted version of the healing teachings of the Archangel Truscott had been the father and mother of pestilence. The Archangel Stavrakis, who had preached the avarice of personal gain over the godly yielding to the Church of God Awaiting that first fruit of every harvest which was God's due. The Archangel Rodriguez, who had preached the arrogant, seductive lie that men were actually capable of setting their own fallible hands to the creation of law under which they might live. The Archangel Asher, father of lies, whose so-called history's twisted version of the true writ had led the mortals foolish enough to believe anything Shan Wei said into equally dark damnation. And, of course, the fallen archangel who was, in so many ways, the darkest of them all, the Archangel Cao Yung, father of destruction, lord of treachery, who had smitten the Archangel Langhorne and the Archangel Bedard traitorously and without warning, after the grieving Langhorne had been compelled to unleash the Rakurai, the lightning bolt of God, upon Shan Wei and her fallen followers. Cao Yung, who had been the most trusted of all Langhorne's subordinates, the warrior charged with guarding all that Safehold stood for, who had turned to Shan Wei's evil. It was Cao Yung's monumental treachery, darker even than Shan Wei's original sin, which had so terribly wounded the perishable bodies of the Archangels Langhorne, Bedard, Pasquale, Sondheim, and their most loyal followers, those closest to God himself, that they were forced to leave Safehold with their work unfinished. Merlin had no personal memory of the majority of Shan Wei's fallen archangels. Nimue had found most of them in the computers in her caves, but if the original Nimue had ever met or known them, that knowledge had never been uploaded to her Pika. Yet some of them she had known, and especially Cao Yong and Shan Wei herself. To see them so vilified, to know that 50 generations of men and women they had died to free reviled them not as heroes, but as the darkest of devils, the source of all evil and unhappiness, was like a knife in Merlin's heart. Part of him longed desperately to denounce the writ, to break out his assault shuttle and his recon skimmers and turn the temple into a glowing crater to prove Langhorne's entire religion was built on lies. But he couldn't. Not yet, at any rate. But someday, he told himself yet again, someday the people of Safehold would be ready to hear the truth and to accept it. And when that day came, Shan Wei and Cao Yong and everyone who had died with them would be remembered for who they'd truly been, all they'd truly stood for. Merlin felt the anger stirring deep inside his Mali Sirk heart and mind and closed the book. He supposed he really shouldn't allow himself to dwell on it this way, but when it came right down to it, the writ and the so-called church it served were his true enemies. Prince Hector, Prince Narmon, and all of the others plotting against Karis were impediments to his real struggle, nothing more. Still, he thought, lips quirking in a mustachioed smile, they're certainly the immediate problem, aren't they? So I suppose I ought to be getting on with it. He brought up the digital clock at the corner of his vision and checked the time. He'd recalibrated it to match Safehold's 26-and-a-half-hour day, and it was 2 hours past the 31-minute period Safeholdians knew as Langhorne's Watch. On any other human-colonized planet, it would have been known as Compensate, or simply Comp. The adjustment period required to tweak an alien world's day into something neatly divisible into mankind's standard minutes and hours. On Safehold, anyone who found himself awake at the midnight hour was supposed to spend Langhorne's watch in silent meditation and contemplation of all God had done for him by Langhorne's intervention in the day just past. Somehow, Merlin had never gotten around to spending the watch on just that purpose. He snorted at the thought and boosted the sensitivity of his hearing. The enhancing software sorted through the incoming sounds, confirming the slumbering quiet of Maritha's tower. Given the guard post at the tower's entrance, there was no need for guards or sentries elsewhere, and given the limitations of their nighttime lighting, Safeholdians tended to be early to bed and early to rise. By now, all the tower's small population of honored guests sounded to be deeply asleep, and even the attendant servants had retreated to the workrooms and waiting rooms set aside for them on the tower's lowest levels to await the ringing bell if some insomniac should require their services. Which was precisely what Merlin had been waiting for. "Ow," he subvocalized. "Yes, Lieutenant Commander," the AI's voice replied almost instantly over his built-in communicator. "I'm ready," Merlin said. "Send the skimmer in as previously directed." "Yes, Lieutenant Commander." Merlin rose, extinguished the wicks of his lamps, and opened the chamber window. He clambered up onto the thick window ledge and sat there, dangling his legs into the night, leaning one shoulder against the wide embrasure while he gazed out over the harbor. The waterfront was a scene of activity, even this late at night, as longshoremen worked to finish loading cargoes for skippers eager to catch the next tide. There was also, inevitably, activity among the taverns and brothels, and Merlin's boosted hearing carried him snatches of laughter, music, drunken song, and quarrels. He could also hear and see the sentries standing alertly at their posts or walking their beats on the palace's walls, and by zooming in on the guard towers of the harbor fortifications and defensive batteries, he could see the sentries standing watch there as well. He sat there for several minutes, waiting patiently, before Owl spoke again.
"ETA 1 minute, Lieutenant Commander," it said.
"Acknowledged," Merlin subvocalized back, although he supposed it wasn't really necessary. The transmission from the compact, long-ranged communicator built into his Pika chassis about where a biological human would have carried his spleen bounced off the Snark hanging in geosynchronous orbit over the Anvil, the large sea or small ocean north of Margaret's Land, to Owl's master array 14,000 kilometers, no, 8,700 miles, damn it, he corrected himself, distant in the Mountains of Light. The Snark, like the array itself, was heavily stealthed, which might not be quite as excessive a precaution as Merlin had thought when he originally arranged it, and so was the vehicle coming silently out of the north above him after loitering safely out at sea all day. Merlin reached out and up, hooking the fingers of his left hand into a crevice between two of Maritha's tower's massive stones for balance. Then he pulled himself into a half-standing position in the window opening. "All right, Owl, collect me," he said. "Yes, Lieutenant Commander," the AI replied, and a tractor beam reached down from the recon skimmer hovering 1,000 meters above Telesburg and scooped Merlin neatly off his window ledge perch. He rose effortlessly and silently through the darkness, watching the city beneath his boots. This was exactly how Langhorne and his so-called angels had managed to come and go so miraculously, and Merlin had been bitterly tempted to make open use of the same capability. His recon skimmer was configured for maximum stealth at the moment, which meant its smart skin fuselage was faithfully duplicating the night sky above it. Effectively, it was as transparent as the air in which it hovered, as invisible to the human eye, or even to Merlin's, as its stealth systems had already rendered it to the vast majority of more sophisticated sensors. But that same smart skin and its normal landing light systems could have been used to produce the blinding brilliance of the Kyusei Hai the angels had used. Coupled with the literally inhuman capabilities built into Merlin's Pika, not to mention the other bits and pieces of advanced technology Cao Yung and Shan Wei had been able to hide away, he could easily have duplicated any feat the angels had ever performed. But Nimu had rejected that possibility almost immediately. Not only had she been instantly and instinctively revolted by the notion of following in Langhorne and Bedard's footsteps, but there'd been more practical objections as well. Sooner or later, she was going to have to tell someone the truth, which was precisely the reason Merlin had never told an outright lie. Continuing to avoid lies was going to become both easier and harder, he suspected, but when the time came that the truth had to be openly revealed, he could not afford to have told a single lie of his own. Not if he wanted whoever it was to believe him when he told them of the far greater lie which had been perpetrated upon their entire planet for so many hundreds of years. Even more to the point, simply replacing one superstition, one false religion, with another would never accomplish the task to which Nimu Alban had set her hand. Decrees from God, to be obeyed without question, wouldn't engender the widespread, independent, inquiring mindset and attitudes which would be required in the decades and centuries to come. And the appearance of an angel preaching a doctrine fundamentally at odds with that of the church and the writ could not help but raise all sorts of accusations of demonic origin, which, in turn, would almost certainly lead to the religious war she'd feared was inevitable anyway, but hoped to at least minimize and hold off for a generation or two. The hovering skimmer's thick armor-plast bubble canopy slid back, and the tractor beam deposited Merlin on the extended, built-in ladder. He climbed it quickly and settled into the comfortable, if not exactly spacious, cockpit's forward flight couch as the ladder retracted back into the fuselage. The canopy slid itself shut over his head, locking with the quiet shush of a good seal, enclosing him in the cool, safe cocoon of the cockpit, and he felt the gentle, unbreakable embrace of the flight couch's activating tractor field as he reached out and laid his hand on the joystick. "I have control, Al," he said. "Acknowledged, Lieutenant Commander. You have control," the AI replied, and Merlin took the skimmer out of hover and eased back on the stick, angling upward as he goosed the throttle. The skimmer accelerated smoothly, and he watched the airspeed indicator climb to 700 kilometers per hour. He could have taken it higher. The atmospheric indicator was calibrated to a speed in excess of Mach 6, but he had no intention of creating sonic booms. Once or twice it might be taken for natural thunder, even on a cloudless night like tonight, but that wouldn't be the case if he made a practice of it. The time might well come when he wouldn't have a choice about that. In the meantime, however, he wasn't about to let himself get into bad habits. He headed northwest from Tellisburg, almost directly away from the site of Caleb's encounter with the Slash Lizard and Narman's assassins, crossing the waterfront and sweeping out over the waters of South Howell Bay. From his increased altitude, he could see the dim lights of the fortress on Sand Shoal Island and Helen Island, hundreds of kilometers out into the bay, but he wasn't interested in them tonight. Instead, he continued onward, swinging further to the west until the steep-shouldered peaks of the Stuyven Mountains loomed ahead of him. The Stuyvens rose like a rampart, a wall across the southern end of the isthmus connecting Caris proper to Margaret's Land. The pronunciation shift in the mountain range's name indicated that it had been christened long after the Archangel Hastings had prepared his maps, probably not more than a few hundred years earlier, and it was only lightly populated even now. Its higher peaks rose to as much as 3,000 meters, 10,000 feet, Merlin corrected himself irritably. He had to get used to thinking in the units of the local measuring system, and population pressure hadn't been sufficient to push settlers up into its inhospitable interior, which suited it quite well to Merlin's requirements. He reached his objective just under 200 miles from the Carisian capital and brought the skimmer back into a hover over the high alpine valley. It didn't look a great deal different from any other stretch of the uninhabited mountains. There were a handful of clusters of terrestrial vegetation, but they were few and far between, lost among the native pines, which really did look quite a bit like the earth tree of the same name, he reflected, aside from their smooth, almost silky bark and even longer needles, and tanglewood thickets. Without terrestrial plants to provide them with habitat, there were none of the transplanted animals and birds whose ranges were still washing steadily outward from the areas of the planet humanity had claimed. There were plenty of examples of Safehold's native fauna, however, and Merlin reminded himself that a slash lizard or a dragon wouldn't realize a pika was indigestible until after it had made the mistake of devouring one. He smiled at the thought of one of the native predators straining to pass the undigested chunks of an unwary pika, and punched up the skimmer's terrain display of the detailed topographical map Owl had generated from the Snark's overflights several 5 days earlier. There. That was what he wanted, and he sent the skimmer sliding slowly and gently forward. The cave entrance was a dark wound in the mountainside. It looked even bigger now that he was here in person, with the skimmer to use as a visual referent, and he guided the slender reconnaissance vehicle through the opening. It was over twice as wide as the skimmer's fuselage and stub wings, and widened still further once he was inside. The vertical stabilizer had ample clearance as well, and he took the skimmer almost 100 meters, 330 feet, he reminded himself as he made the conversion, this time almost automatically, farther in, then pivoted the vehicle in place until its nose pointed once more towards the open night beyond the cave. Not bad, he thought. Not bad at all. In fact, it was almost perfect. less than half an hour from Telesburg, even at the relatively modest velocity he'd allowed himself tonight, it was at least 30 or 40 of the Safeholdian's miles from the nearest human habitation, and the cave was more than large enough to serve as the skimmer's hangar. It was a little on the damp side, with quite a bit of seepage on the southern wall, despite its elevation, but that wouldn't be a factor. Once the skimmer set down and sealed its ports, Merlin could have submerged the thing in salt water and left it there without damaging it. There were signs that something large, probably a dragon, he thought, studying the leavings, and not one of the vegetarian variety, had laired here, but that was all right, too. In fact, it was another plus. Not even a great dragon was going to be able to damage the heavily armored recon skimmer very easily. And should some wandering hunting party actually penetrate into this high mountain valley, they were unlikely to go poking about in a cave which had been claimed by one of Safehold's most fearsome land-going predators. "The rest of the gear isn't as tough as the skimmer, though," he reflected. "Probably be a good idea to leave the sonic system on anyway." His copies of Shanwei's original terraforming notes and progress reports contained enormous amounts of information on the planet's native ecology, and she and her teams had determined the sonic frequencies most effective at repelling the local wildlife. If he played with the power levels a little, he ought to be able to come up with a sonic field which would keep even a dragon safely away from his local equipment depot without driving it into finding another lair. He hovered there, a meter or so, 3 feet, off the cavern's reasonably flat floor. The skimmer's adjustable landing legs were more than long enough to compensate for the inevitable irregularities, and he nodded to himself, pleased by the cave's suitability. "Owl?"
"Yes, Lieutenant Commander?"
"This is going to work very well," he said.
"Go ahead and run the air lorry in tomorrow night. But don't unload anything until I've been able to get back here and fiddle with the skimmer's sonic fences."
"Yes, Lieutenant Commander."
"And don't forget to avoid any population centers on its flight in, either."
"Yes, Lieutenant Commander."
For just a moment, Merlin thought he'd heard something like a trace of exaggerated patience in the AI's voice. But that was ridiculous, of course.
"Do you have the take from the day's surveillance?"
That's another redundant question, he told himself. Of course Owl has the day's take.
"Yes, Lieutenant Commander," the AI said.
"Good. Anything more from Narman and Shandir about Duke Tyrion's involvement in the assassination attempt?"
"No, Lieutenant Commander."
Merlin grimaced unhappily at that. He had nowhere near as much information on the Duke of Tyrion as he would have liked. He'd identified the noble as a player only relatively late in the game, and the Duke was very cautious about the people with whom he met and what he discussed when he met them. He couldn't prevent Merlin from eavesdropping on almost any meeting Merlin knew about, but there didn't seem to be very many meetings of any sort. Almost as irritating, the care he exercised in what he said to his human henchmen when he did meet with one or more of them made analysis difficult. There was no question that he was deep in bed with Narman, although Merlin had been unable to determine the exact point at which he intended to plant his own dagger in the Emerald Prince's back. Unfortunately, given the Duke's rank, relatives, and in-laws, accusing him of treason was going to be a delicate proposition. Which was one reason Merlin hadn't brought it up with Harald, and equally a reason he'd hoped to acquire additional corroborating evidence before he sat down to talk to the king's most trusted counselors in the morning.
"I don't suppose the Duke gave us anything new from his end, did he?" he asked.
"No, Lieutenant Commander."
Merlin grimaced again, this time with a chuckle. According to the manufacturer's manual, a Rapier Tactical Computer's AI had a vocabulary of over 100,000 words. So far, he estimated, Owl must have used at least 60 of them.
"All right, Owl. Go ahead and burst transmit the take to the skimmer's onboard systems. I'll have time to skim through it before I head back to Telesburg."
Yes, Lieutenant Commander.
Owl was perfectly capable of maintaining the critical bugs Merlin had emplaced in various and sundry locations about Safehold. At the moment, they were concentrated in Karras, Emerald, and Coruscant, but he wasn't neglecting Zion or the Kingdom of Tarot. For that matter, Queen Charlian had one permanently parked on the ceiling of her throne room and another in her privy council chamber. Despite the fact that Merlin required far less sleep than any biological human, he couldn't possibly have found time to monitor all of those stealthy spies himself. But Owl had been carefully instructed about the names, places, and events in which Merlin was interested. The AI had also been given a list of more generalized trigger words and phrases, like assassinate, for example, or bribe, and unlike Merlin, it was both designed to monitor multiple inputs simultaneously and immune to boredom. The transmission took only a handful of seconds. Then a green light blinked, indicating completion of the transmission. Merlin nodded in satisfaction, then cocked his head.
"Anything more on your analysis of the Rakurai platforms, Owl?" he asked.
"Affirmative, Lieutenant Commander," the AI replied, then fell silent, and Merlin rolled his eyes.
"In that case, tell me what you've come up with on how to take them out."
"I have not been able to devise a plan to destroy them, Lieutenant Commander," Owl said calmly.
"What?" Merlin sat straighter in his couch, eyes narrowing.
"Why not, Owl?" "The kinetic bombardment and solar energy platforms are nested in the center of a sphere of area defense systems and passive scanners which no weapons at my disposal can hope to penetrate," the AI told him. "Analysis suggests that most of those defenses were emplaced after Commodore Pei's destruction of the original Lake Pei Enclave."
"After Langhorne was dead?"
"Yes, Lieutenant Commander."
Owl's response actually surprised Merlin a bit. The AI wasn't usually very good at recognizing questions, especially what might be rhetorical ones, appropriate for it to answer unless they were specifically directed to it.
"Do you have any hypothesis for why they might have been added at that time?"
"Without better historical data, no reliable, statistically significant hypotheses can be offered," Owl said. "However, modeling of the apparent strategy of the Langhorne administration prior to that time, particularly in light of the fact that Commodore Pei was kept in complete ignorance of the bombardment system's existence before its use against the Alexandria Enclave, would suggest the administrator's successors were concerned that there might be other disloyalists, particularly among the military units the Commodore had commanded. Assuming that to be true, it would perhaps have seemed logical to bolster the platform's defenses against additional attacks."
Merlin frowned, not in disagreement, but in thought, for several seconds, then nodded slowly.
"That does make sense, I suppose," he mused aloud. "Not that it helps our problems very much."
Owl said nothing, and Merlin chuckled harshly at its lack of response. Then he thought some more. The kinetic bombardment platforms which had been used against Shan Wei were still there, sweeping silently in orbit around the planet. It was impossible to be certain, but Merlin was virtually positive the platforms were tasked to bombard and destroy any ground-based energy signature which might indicate that Safeholdians were straying from the dictates of the Book of Zhuozheng's limitations on technology. The energy footprint of an electrical generating plant, for example. The exact level of emissions necessary to activate them was impossible to estimate, but the Book of Chihiro clearly warned that the same Rakurai which had smitten the evil Shan Wei waited to punish anyone so lost to God as to attempt to follow in her footsteps. According to the writ, the lightning associated with natural thunderstorms was God's reminder of the destruction awaiting those who sinned, a sort of inverted mirror image of the symbology of the rainbow's promise to Noah following the deluge.
Owl had been able to get fairly good imagery of the platforms using purely passive systems, but the one snark which had gone active to probe for additional information had been picked off almost instantly by a laser-armed anti-missile platform. Another snark had attempted to penetrate the defended perimeter under maximum stealth, only to be detected and destroyed while it was still thousands of kilometers from the platforms. That had rather conclusively answered the question of whether or not the solar power-powered systems were still active. At the same time, the defensive systems had shown absolutely no interest in any stray emissions Merlin's other snarks, skimmer flights, or comm transmissions might have let slip. Probably would have been just a bit of a problem for their own operations if it had gone around shooting the angels in the ass because of their emissions, he thought mordantly. So the damned thing almost certainly is waiting to kill the first sign of emerging technology outside the Zhuojiang parameters, which doesn't mean it couldn't be used for something else if those damned power sources hiding in the temple told it to. And it's got 6 loaded cells, each capable of covering half a continent at need, by Owl's best estimate. Not good. Not good at all. "We can't get anything close enough to do the job, Owl?" he asked after the better part of a full minute. "Negative, Lieutenant Commander." "Why not?" "Because none of the weapons stockpiled for your use have the range to engage the platforms from outside the range at which the platform's defensive systems can destroy them, Lieutenant Commander. Nor do any of the platforms available to you have the stealth capability to get deep enough into the defended zone to change that fact."
"I see." Merlin grimaced, then shrugged. "Well, if that's the way it is, that's the way it is. We'll just have to cross that bridge when we come to it. And I'm sure that between us we'll be able to come up with a solution eventually."
Owl said nothing, and Merlin chuckled again. Tact or obtuseness, he wondered. Not that it mattered. But whichever it was, there was no point in beating his head against that particular wall right now. He put the problem aside and leaned back in the flight couch once more as he took the skimmer high and allowed its airspeed to climb to Mach 4 on a southwesterly heading. The flight he had in mind would take over an hour, even at that speed, and he punched up the first of Owl's recordings. The local knight was much younger as Merlin switched off the playback from the surveillance bugs 5,000 kilometers and almost an hour and a half later. As always, most of the recorded surveillance data had been boring, irritatingly cryptic, or both. But equally as always, there were more than a few nuggets tucked away amid all the background noise. At the moment, though, that wasn't really foremost in Merlin's thoughts, and his expression tightened as he gazed down at the terrain below him. Armageddon Reef, the locals called it. Once, it had been called Alexandria, but that had been long ago, and its new name was grimly appropriate. Just under 1,000 miles, east to west, that was the width of Rakurai Bay, the bay at the heart of Armageddon Reef, the most accursed spot on Safehold, which had once been home to the Alexandria Enclave. The island upon which that enclave had stood was still there, but it wasn't as large as it had been, and it had been battered into a near-lunar landscape by overlapping impact craters. Langhorne hadn't been content just to destroy Shan Wei's enclave and murder all of her friends and associates. There had been colonists in that enclave as well, some in Alexandria itself, others scattered across the minor continent surrounding the vast bay. They, too, had had to be destroyed, for they might have been infected by Shan Wei's heretical teachings. Besides, Merlin thought harshly, the bastard wanted to make a statement. Hell, he wanted to play with his goddamn toy, that's what he wanted. Rakurai my ass. He realized his hand was tightening dangerously on the stick. Even with the governors he'd set on his Pika strength, he could damage the controls if he really tried, and he forced himself to relax. It was difficult. From his altitude, it was easy for his enhanced vision, despite the darkness, to see how the kinetic bombardment had shredded a roughly circular zone over 1,800 kilometers across. Not just once, either. Nimmu had had plenty of time to run the reports from the snarks she'd dispatched to the site of that long-ago mass murder through Owl's analyzing software. It was readily apparent from the overlapping impact patterns that Langhorn had sent three separate waves of artificial meteors hammering across the continent. And he'd given Alexandria itself even more attention than that. At least five waves of kinetic strikes had marched back and forth across the island. Even now, almost 800 standard years later, the tortured, broken ruin he'd left behind was brutally evident from Merlin's present height. "But he didn't kill quite everyone, did he?" Merlin told himself bitterly. "Oh, no. He needed someone to bear witness, didn't he?" For that was exactly what Langhorn had done. He'd spared a single settlement from destruction so that its stunned and terrified inhabitants could testify to the rain of fiery thunderbolts, the Rakurai of God, which had punished Shan Wei and her fallen fellows for their evil. The archangels who'd swooped down upon that surviving village in the aftermath of the bombardment had borne them away, distributing them in family groups to other towns and villages across Safehold. Officially, they'd been spared because, unlike their fellows, they had been free of sin. As Lot and his family had been spared from the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, they had been spared because they'd remained faithful to God and His revealed laws. In fact, they'd been spared solely so that they could testify to the might and fearsome power of God's fury, and the fate of any who rebelled against His viceroy on Safehold, the Archangel Langhorn. There'd been no reason Merlin had to make this flight. Not really. He'd already known what had happened here, already seen the snark's imagery. There wasn't really any difference between that imagery and what his own artificial eyes reported to the electronic ghost of Nimmu Alban who lived behind them. Yet there was. Oh, but there was. Pikas were programmed to do anything humans could do, and to react naturally, with appropriate changes of expression, to their operators' emotions, unless those operators specifically instructed them not to. Merlin had not so instructed himself, for those natural, automatic reactions, like the scars Nimmu had been careful to incorporate into his appearance, were a necessary part of convincing those about him that he was human. And, electronic, analog, or not, perhaps he truly was still human, a corner of his cybernetic brain reflected as a tear trickled down his cheek. He hovered there, far, far above the scene of that ancient carnage, that long-ago murder which had happened only months ago, as far as he was concerned. He didn't stay long, actually, though it seemed far longer. Just long enough to accomplish the thing he'd come here to do. To mourn his dead, and to promise them that however long it took, whatever challenge might arise, the purpose for which they had died would be achieved. Langhorn and his adherents had named this place Armageddon Reef, the place where good had triumphed over evil for all time. But they'd been wrong, Merlin thought coldly. The atrocity they'd wreaked here had been not the final battle of that struggle, but its first, and the end of the war it had begun would be very different from the one they had envisioned. He hovered there, feeling that promise sinking into his alloy bones, and then he turned the skimmer's nose back into the east, towards the approaching dawn, and left that place of sorrow once again. 8. Royal Palace, Telesburg, Kingdom of Karras.
"Your Majesty," the distinguished-looking man said, bending his head in a respectful bow as he entered the council chamber.
"Regis," K. King Harald responded. The distinguished-looking man straightened and crossed to the chair at the foot of the long table. He paused and stood beside it, waiting, until Harald's waving hand invited him to be seated. He obeyed the gesture, then, and settled into the elaborately carved armchair. Merlin studied him from behind impassive eyes. His snarks and their parasite bugs had observed and listened to this man often over the past few months, but that wasn't quite the same as finally meeting him face to face. Regis Yawance, Earl of Grey Harbor, was Harald VII's first counselor, the senior member of the Privy Council, effectively Karras's prime minister, although the term "and office" hadn't been invented yet on Safehold. He was of less than average height for a Carisian, but he carried his neat, compact frame with the confidence of a man who knew his worth. He was a few years older than Harald, and, unlike the king, he was clean-shaven. The long hair pulled back in the old-fashioned sort of ponytail favored by the more rustic members of the minor nobility and serving sea officers was liberally streaked with silver, but his dark eyes were bright and alert. The chain of office around his neck was less elaborate than Harald's, without the glittering gem sets of the king's, and his tunic's embroidery was more subdued, although its fabric was just as rich, and he, too, wore the golden scepter of the pilgrimage. Despite the superb tailoring and obvious cost of his clothing, he carried an air of physical toughness, as well as the mental toughness one might expect out of the kingdom's first counselor, which probably owed something to the 20 years he'd spent as an officer in the Royal Navy before his childless older brother's death had dropped the Grey Harbor title on him and forced his resignation. The present Earl had gone to sea as a midshipman officer cadet at the ripe old age of 11 and risen to command his own ship by the age of 28, and he'd seen his share of sea fights and bloodshed before he'd become an effete politician. Grey Harbor looked back at Merlin, his face equally impassive, and Merlin smiled mentally. The first counselor had to be alive with curiosity, given all the rumors about the assassination attempt and the crown prince's mysterious rescuer, which had been swirling about the palace. No doubt Grey Harbor had been considerably better informed than almost anyone else, but that wasn't saying a great deal. The king had just opened his mouth to say something more when the council chamber door opened again. Another man came through it, his step considerably more hurried than Grey Harbor's had been. The newcomer was at least a head taller than the earl, and although his clothing was made of rich fabric and jeweled rings glittered on his fingers, he lacked the first counselor's air of polish. He was also younger than Grey Harbor, and considerably more weathered-looking, and he was already going bald. His hooked beak of a nose was high-arched and proud, and his eyes were a lighter shade of brown, almost amber, than most Carisians.
"Your Majesty," he said just a bit gruffly, "I apologize. I came as quickly as I could when my secretary gave me a message."
"There's no need to apologize, Benjamin," Harald said with a smile. "I understood you wouldn't return from Sandshoal until late this evening or tomorrow. I didn't expect you to be able to attend at all, or we would have waited for you."
"I've just returned, Your Majesty,"
Benjamin Race, Baron Wave Thunder, replied. "The matter I'd gone to attend required considerably less time than I'd anticipated."
"I'm glad to hear it," Harald told him. "It will be much more convenient to discuss this with you and Regis at the same time. Please, be seated."
Wave Thunder obeyed the polite command, seating himself in what was obviously his regular place, two chairs down from Grey Harbor, to the Earl's left. Harald waited until he'd settled fully into position, then waved his right hand in Merlin's direction.
"Regis, Benjamin, this is the mysterious Merlin the two of you have undoubtedly heard so much about. Sajin Merlin, the Earl of Grey Harbor, and the Baron of Wave Thunder."
Grey Harbor's eyes grew narrower and even more intent as Harald gave Merlin the Sajin title, but the king continued calmly.
"Regis manages the Privy Council for me, and does most of the hard work of running the kingdom. Benjamin, not to put too fine a point on it, is my spymaster, and very good he is at it, too."
The three men nodded courteously, if warily, to one another, and Harald smiled.
"I realize all sorts of rumors about Sejin Merlin have been running around the palace ever since Caleb got home. Fortunately, no one seems to have realized Merlin really is a Sejin, or what that implies, at least. And for reasons I believe will become clear, I very much want to keep it that way. Given what happened out there in the woods, and the stories, many of them far wilder than the palace gossip, I'm sure, which have to be running about the city as well, people will expect him to receive a certain amount of preference here at court. That's only natural, yet it's important we not show him too much preference. In order to make the best use of his services, however, I believe it will be important for him to have access not simply to me, but also to the council. Exactly how to reconcile those two opposed considerations puzzled me for a time, but I think I've come up with a solution. I intend to name Sejin Merlin to the Royal Guard expressly to serve as Caleb's personal guardsman and bodyguard. Lieutenant Falcon will remain in command of Caleb's normal marine detail, but Merlin will be assigned directly to Caleb, with the understanding that he'll be cooperating with Falcon, but not directly responsible to the lieutenant. I'm sure some in the Marines will resent that, even see it as a slap in their service's face, but I also expect them to learn to live with it. And, after such a close escape, no one will be surprised if we make some changes in our long-standing security arrangements. Assigning him permanently to Caleb will keep him physically close at all times, without officially admitting him to my inner circle of advisers. It's unlikely we'll be able to keep the fact that he's a Sejin from leaking out, of course. When it does, I suggest we all emphasize the tales of the Sejin's martial abilities and downplay any reference to any other unusual talents.
Grey Harbor and Wave Thunder nodded, almost in unison, although it seemed to Merlin that it was more in acknowledgment of Harald's instructions than from any understanding of why the king might have given those instructions in the first place. Which, he reflected, wasn't very surprising after all.
"As part of the effort to divert attention from him," Harald continued, "the two of you are the only members of the council who will know he's anything more than the exceptionally capable warrior assigned to protect Caleb, which he appears to be. Michael also knows, of course, but I intend to restrict that information as much as possible to the three of you, Caleb, and myself, and our personal bodyguards. In time, we'll have to broaden that circle, but I want the minimum possible number of people admitted to the secret. In addition to keeping any of our less friendly neighbors, shall we say, from suspecting the true extent of his talents, that should also prevent him from becoming an object of the sorts of court suspicion and jealousy which would be inevitable if a complete stranger rose abruptly to a position of high power here in Karras."
The king's expression turned briefly grim.
"Nonetheless, the truth is that his talents extend far beyond the field of battle," he said. "I'm strongly of the opinion that those other talents will be of far greater importance to us in the long run, and I expect the three of you are likely to spend quite a bit of time working together."
He paused, as if to allow that to sink in, then looked directly at Grey Harbor.
"Regis, Sejin Merlin managed to impress me even more during our interview yesterday morning than his intervention to save Caleb's life had already done. I went to that meeting prepared to be both skeptical and suspicious. I emerged from it with the belief that Sejin Merlin both means Karras well and has the ability to be of great service to us. I'm sure you'll form your own opinion of him. I value you and Benjamin for your independence of thought as much as for your loyalty and ability. But I want the two of you to listen very carefully to what he has to say. Before I turn all of you loose together, though, let me tell you exactly why he's impressed me as much as he has. To begin with, and since every single thing he told me matched perfectly with everything you've been able to confirm, Benjamin,
the king finished his briefing of his counselors several minutes later,
I had no choice but to accept that he truly does possess the sight. Of course, as I told him at the time, both his abilities and his trustworthiness must be proven before I can consider relying upon him, as I already rely on the two of you. Sejin Merlin was courteous enough to accept that without rancor.
He paused, and both of the counselors looked at Merlin with thoughtful expressions. Wave Thunder looked fascinated, if still faintly skeptical, which wasn't much of a surprise. Grey Harbor also looked skeptical, but unless Merlin was seriously mistaken, at least half of the First Counselor's skepticism was reserved for the mysterious stranger's real motives and ambitions.
Since Sejin Merlin is clearly much better informed about events and the people behind them here in Telesburg and in Karis generally than most newcomers,
the king continued dryly after a few moments,
it seemed to me that the first thing for us to do would be for the three of you to discuss our concerns about our less friendly neighbors' representatives among us. I want you and Benjamin to combine what we already know with what Sejin Merlin can tell us, Regis. This attempt to murder Caleb wasn't exactly completely unexpected, but it does represent a decision on someone's part to significantly raise the stakes. I think it's time we considered suggesting to them that attempts to murder the heir to the throne are unwise.
The king's tone was light, almost whimsical. His eyes were not.
I understand, Your Majesty,
Grey Harbor replied with a nod that was half a bow. Then he cocked his head slightly.
Just how firmly would you like that message delivered, sire?
Very firmly, where the individuals actually involved in this attempt are concerned,
Harald said in a rather colder tone.
That much, I think, everyone will expect, assuming we can determine just who was responsible. And, frankly, I intend to take quite a bit of personal satisfaction out of seeing to it no one's disappointed in that respect. For the rest of our local spies, a somewhat more restrained reaction may be in order. I still want them made nervous, you understand?
I believe we do, Your Majesty, Wave Thunder said gruffly. But just to be completely clear, you aren't instructing us to reverse our policy on known spies.
Probably not, Harald said, and shrugged slightly. Leaving the ones we know about in place to discourage their masters from sending in new ones has served us well so far. On the other hand, what almost happened to Caleb indicates they can still circumvent our surveillance. Besides, they have to know we've identified at least some of their agents, and after something like this, they'll expect us to devote some attention to house cleaning. If we don't move against at least a few of them, they'll wonder why we didn't. For now, assume anyone on the secondary list is fair game, and use your own judgment as to which of them will be most useful removed from play and which left in place. On the primary list, get my approval before moving against anyone.
And what shall we do with the information provided by Sejin Merlin?
Grey Harbor asked in an almost painfully neutral tone.
I'll trust you and Benjamin's judgment when it comes to deciding which list to put any new names on,
Harald told him.
Take no action against anyone you put on the primary list without first discussing it with me. As far as anyone on the secondary list is concerned, I'm prepared to rely on your judgment.
"Understood, Your Majesty," Grey Harbor said.
"Thank you."
Harald pushed back his chair and stood, and the other three quickly stood in turn, bending their heads respectfully. The king watched them, then smiled at his first counselor and shook his head slightly.
"I know exactly what you're thinking, Regis," he said. "I suspect Sejin Merlin does, too. Still, you're much too intelligent to allow that ingrained suspicion of yours to cloud your judgment. Besides, I predict you're going to be just as surprised by the Sejin's talents as I was."
"It's not Sejin Merlin's talents which concern me, sire," Grey Harbor said with a thin smile which acknowledged the accuracy of his monarch's observation.
"Oh, I know that," Harald chuckled, "and so does the Sejin, but I still think you're going to be surprised."
He smiled again, this time at all three of them, and limped out of the council chamber. "And Mulvane is running an entire ring of agents out of the crossed anchors for Maison," Merlin finished up his basic report the better part of an hour later. "The tavern keeper is one of Mulvane's people, but most of the agents he's overseeing really think they're working for the representative of a legitimate foreign banker whose interests are firmly entwined with your own merchant houses. They think they're providing basically commercial information without realizing how useful that information could be to Hector, or what can be deduced from it." Wave Thunder nodded without looking up from several sheets of paper on which he was still busily jotting notes. Unlike Grey Harbor, the Baron had not been born to the nobility. His father had been a common ship's master, and Benjamin Race had earned his patent of nobility by rising from that beginning to become one of Telesburg's great business magnates. He'd trained as a clerk along the way, and still had the fast, clearly legible handwriting he'd developed then. It continued to serve him well, since his duties as the head of Harald's intelligence apparatus left him disinclined to trust secretaries when it came to taking sensitive notes. Now he sat back, finally, studying what he'd written, then glanced at Grey Harbor before looking at Merlin.
"I'm as impressed as His Majesty predicted, Sejin Merlin," he said, gathering up the dozen-plus sheets of closely written notes. "By all the information you've just provided, of course, but also by your ability to keep track of all that without notes of your own."
"I, too, am impressed," Earl Grey Harbor agreed, lounging back in his own chair, regarding Merlin from hooded eyes.
"I'm also impressed," Wave Thunder continued, "by the fact that so far as I'm aware, every single major foreign agent we've been able to identify is on your list as well. As I'm sure you're aware, that sort of corroboration is always valuable. And, to be honest, it lends additional weight to your information about agents we haven't been able to identify. Like this entire secondary ring Lahang is running in North Key."
He shook his head.
"I suppose I should have realized he'd have to have someone else to act as his eyes and ears that far from Telesburg, but we've never had as much as a sniff of who it might actually be."
"I wouldn't feel too badly about that, Baron," Merlin said with a shrug. "I have certain advantages your regular investigators don't. If I'd had to investigate the same way they do, I'd never have been able to discover as much as I'm sure you already know."
"No doubt," Grey Harbor said thoughtfully. "At the same time, Sejin Merlin, I must admit I'm curious as to just how it happens that you've seen so much about Karnas."
Merlin arched one eyebrow as the First Counselor shrugged.
"It just seems odd that a Sejin from the Mountains of Light should be granted such detailed visions of events this far from the Temple Lands that you can identify individual tavern keepers working for Prince Hector."
Wave Thunder frowned slightly, sitting back in his own chair and looking back and forth between the other two men. Merlin, on the other hand, smiled slightly.
"It's not as odd as you might think, my lord," he said.
I do have some control over the sorts of things I see, you know.
Indeed?
Greyharbor sounded politely skeptical.
In all the tales I've ever heard or read, the visions of a Seijin seem to be cryptic, one might say, or perhaps non-specific. Yet your visions, Seijin Merlin, appear to be extremely specific.
I would suspect, Merlin said, that quite a few of those non-specific visions from the tales you've heard were works of fiction. He leaned back in his own chair with an amused smile. Either they never happened at all, or else they were embroidered, let's say, by the people who reported them. While it pains me to admit it, I'm sure more than one Seijin was little more than a common charlatan. In a case like that, the more cryptic a so-called vision, the better. A little space for loose interpretation would go a long way towards maintaining someone's credibility.
That's certainly true enough.
Greyharbor seemed a bit taken aback by Merlin's direct response. My lord, the blue-eyed stranger said, when I first began having these visions of mine, they came from all over Safehold. Indeed, they were quite bewildering in a great many ways. But I soon discovered that by concentrating on places and people of special interest, I could redirect, or possibly focus would be a better word, subsequent visions.
And you chose to focus them here, on Kharis?
Yes, I did. I don't blame you for being skeptical, my lord. That's one of your duties to the king. However, I've already explained to His Majesty exactly what it was which attracted me to Kharis in the first place. And, to be frank, at this particular moment, Kharis needs all the advantages she can get.
That's true enough, Regis, Wave Thunder said.
He began jogging his sheets of notes into a tidy sheaf.
And while I'm as suspicious as the next man, the Baron continued, so far, at least, Seijin Merlin's credentials seem to be standing up quite well. I had my suspicions about who was behind that assassination attempt on the prince, but none of my people had picked up the connection between Lang and his mercenaries. Now that it's been pointed out, though, I expect we'll be able to confirm it. It makes sense, anyway.
I know, Greyharbor sighed. I suppose it's just... The First Counselor grimaced, then looked at Merlin with an odd little half-smile.
You're certainly right about our needing every advantage we can get, he said in a more open tone. Perhaps it's just that I've felt we were trying to stave off krakens with a barge pole for so long that I simply find it hard to believe this sort of help could just fall into our laps, as it were.
I can understand that. Merlin looked at him for several moments, then glanced back at Wave Thunder. I can understand that, he repeated, and because I do, I've hesitated to mention one more name to you.
You have?
Greyharbor's eyes narrowed, and Wave Thunder frowned. There's one more highly placed spy, Merlin said slowly. Highly placed enough that I'd originally intended not to mention him at all, until after you'd had the opportunity to evaluate the reliability of the other information I could provide.
Where? Who are you talking about?
Greyharbor leaned forward, his voice once more edged with suspicion. My lord, if I tell you that, it will cause you great distress.
I'll be the best judge of that, Seijin Merlin,
the Earl said, with the crisp, hard-edged authority of the kingdom's first counselor. Very well, my lord. Merlin bent his head in a small bow of acknowledgment, not in submission. I'm afraid the Duke of Tirion is not the man you think he is. Greyharbor sat back abruptly. For a moment, his expression was simply shocked. Then his face darkened angrily.
"How dare you say such a thing?" he demanded harshly.
"I dare a great many things, my lord," Merlin said flatly, his own expression unyielding. "And I speak the truth. I told you it would distress you.
That much, at least, was the truth,
Greyharbor snapped.
I greatly doubt the rest of it was.
Regis, Wave Thunder began, but Greyharbor cut him off with a sharp, abrupt wave of his hand, never taking his own furious eyes off Merlin.
When the king told us to work with you, I doubt very much that he ever suspected for a moment that you would tell us his own cousin is a traitor, he grated.
I'm sure he didn't, Merlin agreed. And I'm not surprised by your anger, my lord. After all, you've known the Duke since he was a boy. Your daughter is married to him. And, of course, he stands fourth in the succession, and he's always been King Harald's staunch supporter, both in the Privy Council and in Parliament as well. You've known me less than 2 hours. It would astonish me if you were prepared to take my unsupported word that a man you've known and trusted for so long is in fact a traitor. Unfortunately, that doesn't change the truth.
Truth?
Greyharbor hissed.
Is that what this has been all about? Who sent you to discredit the Duke?
No one sent me anywhere except my own will, Merlin replied. And I seek to discredit no one except those whose own actions have already discredited them.
Not one more lie! I won't... Regis!
Wave Thunder looked unhappy, but the sharpness in his voice pulled Greyharbor's eyes back to him. The First Counselor glared, and Wave Thunder shook his head.
Regis,
he said again, his voice much closer to normal. I think we need to listen to what he has to say.
What?
Greyharbor stared at his fellow counselor in disbelief.
My own people have reported a few irregularities where the Duke is concerned,
Wave Thunder said uncomfortably.
What sort of irregularities?
Greyharbor demanded incredulously.
Most of them were small things, Wave Thunder admitted. Company he kept, a few instances in which known Emerald agents slipped through our hands in Hyratha when we'd alerted the authorities to take them, trading ventures that proved unusually profitable for him and in which Emerald merchant interests were deeply involved. And the fact that he's been Lahang's best customer for wyverns, as far as we can tell.
Don't be ridiculous,
Greyharbor said coldly.
The Duke, my son-in-law, I remind you, is addicted to the hunt. His wyvern coop is the biggest, most expensive one in the entire kingdom. Of course he's Lahang's best customer. For God's sake, Binzerman, we've known all along that Lahang's cover was chosen expressly to give him access to people just like Calvin. If you're going to accuse him on that basis, you'll have to accuse half the nobles in Karis.
Which is why I haven't accused him of anything yet, Wave Thunder said rather more sharply. I said it was small things, and no one is going to accuse someone in the Duke's position of treason on the basis of such flimsy evidence. Not when he's so close to the crown, and when he's so openly and strongly supported the king for so long. But that doesn't change the reports I've received, and it doesn't necessarily make Sejin Merlin a liar, which, the Baron looked Greyharbor straight in the eye, is exactly what you're accusing him of being.
Hasn't he just accused the Duke of far worse?
Greyharbor snapped back.
Yes, he has, Wave Thunder said, his voice even flatter than Merlin's had been. And what if he's right?
The very idea is preposterous.
Which doesn't mean it can't be true, Wave Thunder said unflinchingly. This is my area of responsibility, Regis. I don't want Sejin Merlin to be right about the Duke, but it's my responsibility to consider the possibility that he might be. And it's your responsibility to let me do my job and find out.
Greyharbor glared at him for several taut seconds. Then he looked back at Merlin, and his dark eyes were bitter with fury.
Very well, he gritted.
Do your job, Benjamin. And when you've proved there isn't a single word of truth in it, do your job and investigate this man, too. As for me, I'm afraid I have other duties at the moment.
He stood, jerked an angry bow at Wave Thunder, and stalked out of the chamber without even glancing in Merlin's direction again. 9. Baron Wave Thunder's office, Telesburg.
I'm afraid it looks as if there may be something to it, my lord.
Benjamin Race leaned back in his chair, his expression unhappy. Sir Rizzard Seafarmer, his second-in-command, looked equally unhappy. Sir Rizzard had primary responsibility for Wave Thunder's counterintelligence operations, although that, too, was a term which had not yet been reinvented on Safehold. He was Wave Thunder's most trusted subordinate, both for his loyalty and his judgment, and he was also a very intelligent man. Wave Thunder hadn't told him the identity of the Duke's accuser, but the Baron felt confident Seafarmer had deduced his identity. Sir Rizzard, however, had half a lifetime of experience in not asking questions about things he wasn't supposed to know, and Wave Thunder trusted his discretion completely. At the moment, Seafarmer was also the man who'd just spent the last 2 days going back over every scrap of information they had on the Duke of Tirion. The Duke had worked closely with Wave Thunder and Seafarmer on more than one occasion, given his rank and his duties. Tirion was inside many of the kingdom's critical strategies, privy to most of the king's secrets, both personal and political, and he'd been there literally for decades. Which, because Seafarmer was as experienced as he was intelligent, meant he understood precisely where this particular pocketful of worms could lead.
"I don't like admitting that for several reasons," Seafarmer continued after a moment. "First, of course, because of how messy this could turn out to be, and for how much it's going to hurt His Majesty. But I'm almost equally unhappy about the fact that without this new information, wherever it came from," he added dutifully, "we probably never would have realized there could be anything serious to look at in the first place."
"Not too surprising, really, I suppose," Wave Thunder sighed. He pinched the bridge of his proud nose, balding scalp gleaming in the sunlight streaming in through the window behind him, and shook his head. "No one wants to be the first to point a finger at the kingdom's second-ranking noble, Rizzard. And no one wants to believe someone who stands that high in the succession could be a traitor in the first place."
"It's happened other places," Seafarmer pointed out grimly. "I should have borne in mind that it could happen here as well, my lord." "You should have, I should have," Wave Thunder waved his hand. "Neither of us did, and now that we have, I don't want us jumping to hasty conclusions of guilt because we feel like we ought to have been suspicious all along."
"Point taken, my lord."
Seafarmer nodded, and Wave Thunder reached out to toy with a paperweight on his desk while he considered his subordinate's report. Wave Thunder himself was proof of how open the kingdom of Karras's nobility was, compared with those of most other kingdoms of Safehold, and he and King Harald believed in using the best talent available, regardless of how blue or not blue that talent's blood might be. That policy had served them well over the years, but it had its drawbacks too, and one of them was that, however open the Carisian aristocracy might be, commonly born men still hesitated to accuse great nobles of wrongdoing. Partly that was the result of innate respect, the belief that certain people simply had to be above suspicion. That, Wave Thunder felt sure, was the category to which Seafarmer, just as Wave Thunder himself, had assigned Calvin Armagh, the Duke of Tirion, in his own mind. After all, the present Duke was the only living son of the king's only uncle. Although his father, Arryn, had been Harald the Sixth's younger brother, he was actually a few years older than Harald, since Arryn, like Calvin himself, had married late. He and Harald had been raised more like brothers than cousins, and he was Caleb's godfather, as well as his cousin. He was also Constable of Hyratha, the key fortress city on Tirion Island. Hirotha was arguably the second or third most important naval base of the entire kingdom, placed to dominate the northern half of Howell Bay, and its constable was traditionally considered the senior Carisian military officer after High Admiral Locke Island himself. Not only that, but Tyrion was one of the senior leaders of the king's party in the House of Lords, an unwavering advocate of King Harald's policies, one of the king's most trusted diplomatic representatives, and the son-in-law of the kingdom's first counselor. Surely he, of all people, simply could not be a traitor. But, as Sea Farmer had just pointed out, it had happened other places, which was where the fact that so many of Wave Thunder's best investigators were common-born might well come into play. It was possible that someone who was nobly born himself might have been more willing to cherish suspicions about a fellow aristocrat. More to the point, however, he might have been more likely to risk voicing any suspicions he did cherish about such a powerful potential enemy. Even in Karras, a commoner who made an enemy among the high aristocracy was unlikely to prosper, and the same held true for his family. It was a potential blind spot Wave Thunder was going to have to pay more attention to in the future, because although he just cautioned Sea Farmer against leaping to any conclusions, the Baron himself felt a sinking surety of the Duke's guilt. Merlin Athrawes had provided too much other information whose veracity could be tested, and so far, every single thing he'd told them, and which Wave Thunder's agents had been able to test, had proved accurate. It was always remotely possible that Grey Harbor's suspicion that it was all part of some elaborate, convoluted plot to damage the Crown's faith in the Duke was correct. The very factors which had placed Tyrion above suspicion made him vitally important to the kingdom and its security. If, in fact, he was as loyal as everyone had always believed him to be, then discrediting him, possibly even driving him into rebellion as his only defense against false accusations, would be a tremendous coup for any of Karras's many enemies. But Wave Thunder didn't believe it for a moment. And had Grey Harbor been even a little less closely associated with Tyrion, the Baron suspected, the First Counselor wouldn't have believed it either. Unfortunately, the Earl was that closely associated with the Duke. And then there was the little matter of the fact that Tyrion was also King Harald's first cousin, and that both the King and the Crown Prince held him in deep affection. "We have to move very cautiously here, Izzard," the Baron said finally. Sea Farmer didn't reply, but his expression was one of such emphatic agreement that Wave Thunder's lips twitched. Clearly, that was one of the more unnecessary warnings he'd ever issued. "Do you have any thoughts on how best to approach the problem?" he continued.
"That depends upon the answer to a rather delicate question, my lord."
"I'm sure it does," Wave Thunder said dryly.
"And no, I don't think we want to tell the king about this until we're more confident there actually is something to tell him. He's going to be badly hurt, if there's any truth to it. And he's going to be angry, whatever happens, even if it all proves to be a false alarm. But if we tell him about this before we're sure, it's likely to adversely affect our investigation's secrecy. His Majesty is one of the canniest men I know, but I'm not certain how well he'd be able to dissemble if he thought the Duke was a traitor. And," he chose not to add aloud, "as long as we keep it just between ourselves, something I authorized without His Majesty's knowledge or approval, he'll have someone to throw to the Krakens if it turns out the Duke is innocent after all."
Wave Thunder didn't find contemplating that possibility especially cheering, but it came with his job. And if the Duke was in fact innocent, his importance to the kingdom would make placating his possible fury at having been wrongly suspected a high priority for King Harald.
"That limits the possibilities, my lord,"
Sea Farmer pointed out respectfully. He wasn't complaining. Obviously, he'd followed the same chain of logic, but simply considering the practical implications.
The Duke's own guardsmen are very, very good, and they're intimately familiar with how we go about things. They ought to be. They've helped us do it often enough.
So if we try anything like sneaking one of our people inside his household, we're more likely to alert him to the fact that we're suspicious than we are to succeed.
And we can't get at his private correspondence either, Wave Thunder agreed.
The Duke's public correspondence, associated with the offices he held by royal appointment, like his position as Constable of Hyratha, was another matter. That, the Baron was confident, he could gain access to without undue difficulty. And he was quite confident it would do him absolutely no good after he'd done it. He'd do it anyway, of course, just in case, but he'd be astonished if anything were to come of it.
If we knew exactly what he's doing, assuming, of course, that he is doing something,
Sea Farmer qualified scrupulously,
it would make things a lot easier. If we knew he was passing information and suspected who he was passing it to, we could try planting false information on him and see how the other side reacted. But all I can really tell you is that he seems to be spending an inordinate amount of time with people we've determined are in Narmin's pocket, one way or another. Like Baron Black Wyvern, and Lahang, of course, and...
Sea Farmer's expression turned grimmer.
There's that little matter of those Emerald agents who seem to keep getting lost in Hyratha.
Wave Thunder nodded, but he hadn't missed the way Sea Farmer's eyes narrowed. Two of the suspected Emerald agents who'd somehow managed to elude apprehension in Hyratha had cut the throats of a pair of Sea Farmer's most trusted investigators before making their escape. Investigators who'd come to Hyratha with what should have been perfect covers, and the Duke's knowledge of their identities and mission. In fact, the Duke had been the only person in Hyratha who'd been informed of their presence, precisely because Narmin's agents there had so persistently escaped arrest in the past. Sea Farmer had double and triple checked to be certain of that, which meant the Duke was also the only person in Hyratha who could have given their identities away. That didn't necessarily prove anything. The secret might have been compromised at the Telesburg end when Sea Farmer first sent them out, or one of the investigators might have been known to the other side from a previous case. Unlikelier things had happened in the past, and would again. And even if the Duke was responsible for the information leakage, he might well have revealed it inadvertently. For that matter, Narmin might have succeeded in getting a spy inside the Duke's official household in a position to compromise the information without his knowledge. The problem was finding out whether or not that was what had happened. And until Wave Thunder managed to do that, he couldn't really afford to act on any of the rest of Merlin's information. Certainly not on any of that information he couldn't independently confirm.
All right, the Baron said after a moment. I think we need to go about this in two separate ways. First, I want the people we have watching him to be reinforced, and I'm sure I don't need to tell you how important it is to be absolutely sure of the loyalty of anyone we assign to this, Rizzard.
Of course not, my lord.
And second, Wave Thunder said grimly, I think we need to set a little trap.
A trap, my lord?
Sir Rizzard repeated, and Wave Thunder nodded again.
As you say, if we knew who he was passing information to, we could try feeding him false information to pass them.
Well, perhaps we do know, in a general sense, someone to whom he's passing it.
Sea Farmer looked puzzled, and Wave Thunder snorted harshly.
You just said it yourself, Rizzard. Narmin's people in Hyratha seem to have become rather more elusive than those anywhere else in the kingdom.
Ah, I see, my lord, Sea Farmer said, and his eyes began to gleam.